The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, I'm John Biondi, and today I'll be reading When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Copyrighted in 2016. Published by Random House. First, a word about the author. At the age of 36, on the verge of completing a decade's worth of training as a neurosurgeon, Paul Kalanithi was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. One day, he was a doctor treating the dying, and the next he was a patient struggling to live. And just like that, the future he and his wife had imagined evaporated. When Breath Becomes Air chronicles Kalanithi's transformation from a naive medical student possessed, as he wrote, by the question of what, given that all organisms die, makes a virtuous and meaningful life, into a neurosurgeon at Stanford working in the brain, the most critical place for human identity, and finally into a patient and new father confronting his own mortality. What makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future, no longer a ladder toward your goals of life, flattens out into a perpetual presence? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another one fades away? These are some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this profoundly moving, exquisitely observed memoir. Paul Kalanithi died in March 2015 while working on this book, yet his words live on as a guide and a gift to us all. Quote, I began to realize that coming face to face with my own mortality, in a sense, had changed nothing and everything, unquote, he wrote. Quote, seven words from Samuel Beckett began to repeat in my head. I can't go on. I'll go on. Unquote. When Breath Becomes Air is an unforgettable, life-affirming reflection on the challenge of facing death and on the relationship between doctor and patient from a brilliant writer who became both. Paul Kalanithi was a neurosurgeon and writer. He grew up in Kingman, Arizona, and graduated from Stanford University with a B.A. and an M.A. in English Literature and a B.A. in Human Biology. He earned an M.Phil in History and Philosophy of Science and Medicine from the University of Cambridge and graduated cum laude from the Yale School of Medicine, where he was inducted into the Alpha Omega Alpha National Medical Honor Society. He returned to Stanford to complete his residency, training in neurological surgery and a postdoctoral fellowship in neuroscience, during which he received the American Academy of Neurological Surgery's highest award for research. He died in March 2015. He is survived by his large, loving family, including his wife Lucy and their daughter Elizabeth Acadia. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. Now, let us begin with When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Events described are based on Dr. Kalanithi's memory of real-world situations. However, the names of all patients discussed in this book, if given at all, have been changed. In addition, in each of the medical cases described, identifying details such as patients' ages, genders, ethnicities, professions, familial relationships, places of residence, medical histories, and/or diagnoses have been changed. With one exception, the names of Dr. Kalanithi's colleagues, friends, and treating physicians have also been changed. Any resemblance to persons living or dead resulting from changes to names or identifying details is entirely coincidental and unintentional. The book is dedicated for Katie. You that seek what life is in death, now find it air that once was breath. New names unknown all names gone, till time ends bodies, but souls none. Reader, then make time while you be, but steps to your eternity. Baron Brooke Fulke Grenville, Cilicia, 83. Foreword by Abraham Verghese. It occurs to me, as I write this, that the foreword to this book might be better thought of as an afterword, because when it comes to Paul Kalanithi, all sense of time is turned on its head. To begin with, or maybe to end with, I got to know Paul only after his death. Bear with me. I came to know him most intimately when he'd ceased to be. I met him one memorable afternoon at Stanford in early February 2014. He'd just published an op-ed titled How Long Have I Got Left in the New York Times, an essay that would elicit an overwhelming response, an outpouring from readers. In the ensuing days, it spread exponentially. I'm an infectious disease specialist, so please forgive me for not using the word viral as a metaphor. In the aftermath of that, he asked to come to see me, to chat, to get advice about literary agents, editors, the publishing process. He had a desire to write a book. This book, the one you are now holding in your hands. I recall the sun filtering through the magnolia tree outside my office and lighting this scene. Paul seated before me, his beautiful hands exceedingly still, his prophet's beard full, those dark eyes taking the measure of me. In my memory, the picture has a Vermeer-like quality, a camera obscura sharpness. I remember thinking, you must remember this, because what was falling on my retina was precious. And because, in the context of Paul's diagnosis, I became aware of not just his mortality, but of my own. We talked about a lot of things that afternoon. He was a neurosurgical chief resident. We had probably crossed paths at some point, but we hadn't shared a patient that we could recall. He told me he had been an English and biology major as an undergraduate at Stanford and then stayed on for a master's in English literature. We talked about his lifelong love of writing and reading. I was struck by how easily he could have been an English professor, and indeed, he had seemed to be headed down that path at one point in his life. But then, just like his namesake on the road to Damascus, he felt the calling. He became a physician instead, but one who always dreamed of coming back to literature in some form. A book, perhaps, one day. He thought he had time, and why not? And yet, now time was the very thing he had so little of. I remember his wry, gentle smile, a hint of mischief there, even though his face was gaunt and haggard. He'd been through the ringer with this cancer, but a new biological therapy had produced a good response, allowing him to look ahead a bit. He said during medical school he'd assumed that he would become a psychiatrist, only to fall in love with neurosurgery. It was much more than a falling in love with the intricacies of the brain, much more than the satisfaction of training his hands to accomplish amazing feats. It was a love and empathy for those who suffered, for what they endured and what he might bring to bear. I don't think he told me this as much as I had heard about this quality of his from students of mine who were his acolytes, his fierce belief in the moral dimension of his job. And then we talked about his dying. After that meeting, we kept in touch by mail, but never saw each other again. It was not just that I disappeared into my own world of deadlines and responsibilities, but also my strong sense that the burden was on me to be respectful of his time. It was up to Paul if he wanted to see me. I felt that the last thing he needed was the obligation to service a new friendship. I thought about him a lot, though, and about his wife. I wanted to ask him if he was writing. Was he finding the time? For years, as a busy physician, I'd struggled to find the time to write. I wanted to tell him that a famous writer, commiserating about this eternal problem, once said to me, if I were a neurosurgeon and I announced that I had to leave my guests to go in for an emergency craniotomy, no one would say a word. But if I said I needed to leave the guest in the living room to go upstairs to write, I wondered if Paul would have found this funny. After all, he could actually say he was going to do a craniotomy. It was plausible, and then he could go on writing instead. While Paul was writing this book, he published a short, remarkable essay in Stanford Medicine in an issue that was devoted to the idea of time. I had an essay in the same issue, my piece juxtaposed to his, though I learned of his contribution only when the magazine was in my hands. In reading his words, I had a second, deeper glimpse of something of which there had been a hint in the New York Times essay. Paul's writing was simply stunning. He could have been writing about anything, and it would have been just as powerful. But he wasn't writing about anything. He was writing about time and what it meant to him now in the context of his illness, which made it all so incredibly poignant. But here's the thing I must come back to. The prose was unforgettable. Out of his pen, he was spinning gold. I reread Paul's piece again and again, trying to understand what he had brought about. First, it was musical. It had echoes of Galway Kinnell, almost a prose poem. Quote, if one day it happens, you find yourself with someone you love in a cafe at one end of the Port Mirabeau at the Zinc Bar, where wine stands in upward opening glasses, unquote, to quote a Kinnell line, from a poem I once heard him recite in a bookstore in Iowa City, never looking down at his paper. But it also had a taste of something else, something from an antique land, from a time before zinc bars. It finally came to me a few days later when I picked up his essay yet again. Paul's writing was reminiscent of Thomas Brown. Brown had written Religio Medici in the prose of 1642 with all its archaic spellings and speech. As a young physician, I was obsessed with that book, kept at it like a farmer trying to drain a log that his father before him had failed to drain. It was a futile task, and yet I was desperate to learn its secrets, tossing it aside in frustration, then picking it up again, unsure that it had anything for me, but in sounding the words, sensing that it did. I felt that I lacked some critical receptor for the letters to sing to impart their meaning. It remained opaque, no matter how hard I tried. Why, you ask? Why did I persevere? Who cares about Religio Medici? Well, my hero, William Oscar, cared. That's who. Osler was the father of modern medicine, a man who died in 1919. He loved the book. He kept it on his nightstand. He'd asked to be buried with a copy of Religio Medici. For the life of me, I didn't get what Osler saw in it. After many tries, and after some decades, the book finally revealed itself to me. It helped that a newer edition had modern spellings. The trick, I discovered, was to read it aloud, which made the cadence inescapable. Quote, we carry with us the wonders we seek without us. There is all Africa and her progenies in us. We are that bold and adventurous piece of nature, which he that studies wisely learns in the compendium what others labor at in a divided piece, an endless volume, unquote. When you come to the last paragraph of Paul's book, read it aloud and you will hear that same long line, the cadence you think you can tap your feet to. But as with Brown, you will be just off. Paul, it occurred to me, was Brown redo, or given that forward time is our illusion. Perhaps it's that Brown was Kalanithi's redo. Yes, it's head-spinning stuff. And then Paul died. I attended his memorial in the Stanford Church, a gorgeous space where I often go when it is empty to sit and admire the light, the silence, and where I always find renewal. It was packed for the service. I sat off to one side, listening to a series of moving and sometimes raucous stories from his closest friends, his pastor and his brother. Yes, Paul was gone, but strangely, I felt I was coming to know him beyond that visit in my office, beyond the few essays he'd written. He was taking form in those tales being told in the Stanford Memorial Church, its soaring cathedral dome, a fitting space in which to remember this man whose body was now in the earth, but who nevertheless was so palpably alive. He took form in the shape of his lovely wife and baby daughter, his grieving parents and siblings, in the faces of the legions of friends, colleagues, and former patients who filled that space. He was there at the reception later, outdoors in a setting where so many came together. I saw faces looking calm, smiling, as if they had witnessed something profoundly beautiful in the church. Perhaps my face was like that too. We had found meaning in the ritual of a service, in the ritual of eulogizing, in the shedded tears. There was further meaning residing in this reception where we slaked our thirst, fed our bodies, and talked with complete strangers to whom we were intimately connected through Paul. But it was only when I received the pages that you now hold in your hands, 2 months after Paul died, that I felt I had finally come to know him, to know him better than if I had been blessed to call him a friend. After reading the book you are about to read, I confess I felt inadequate. There was an honesty, a truth in the writing that took my breath away. Be ready. Be seated. See what courage sounds like. See how brave it is to reveal yourself in this way. But above all, see what it is to still live, to profoundly influence the lives of others after you are gone, by your words. In a world of asynchronous communication, where we are so often buried in our screens, our gaze rooted to the rectangular objects buzzing in our hands, our attention consumed by ephemera, stop and experience this dialogue with my young departed colleague, now ageless and extant in memory. Listen to Paul. In the silences between his words, listen to what you have to say back. Therein lies his message. I got it. I hope you experience it too. It is a gift. Let me not stand between you and Paul. The Prologue. Webster was much possessed by death, and saw the skull beneath the skin, and breathless creatures underground lean backward with a lipless grin. That was written by T.S. Eliot, Whispers of Immortality. I flipped through the CT scan images. The diagnosis was obvious. The lungs were matted with innumerable tumors, the spine deformed, a full lobe of the liver obliterated, cancer widely disseminated. I was a neurosurgical resident entering my final year of training. Over the last 6 years, I had examined scores of such scans on the off chance that some procedure might benefit the patient. But this scan was different. It was my own. I wasn't in the radiological suite wearing my scrubs and white coat. I was dressed in a patient's gown, tethered to an IV pole using the computer the nurse had left in my hospital room with my wife Lucy, an internist, at my side. I went through each sequence again, the lungs window, the bone window, the liver window, scrolling from top to bottom, then left to right, then front to back, just as I had been trained to do, as if I might find something that would change the diagnosis. We lay together on the hospital bed. Lucy, quietly, as if reading from a script, "Do you think there's any possibility that it's something else?" "No," I said. We held each other tightly, like young lovers. In the past years, we'd both suspected but refused to believe or even discuss that a cancer was growing inside me. About 6 months before, I had started losing weight and having furious back pain. When I dressed in the morning, my belt cinched one, then two notches tighter. I went to see my primary care doctor, an old classmate from Stanford. Her sister had died suddenly as the neurosurgery intern after contracting a virulent infection, and so she'd taken a maternal watch on my health. When I arrived, however, I found a different doctor in her office. My classmate was on maternity leave. Dressed in a thin blue gown on a cold examining table, I described the symptoms to her. Of course, I said, if this were a board's exam question, 35-year-old with unexplained weight loss and new onset back pain, the obvious answer would be C, cancer. But maybe it's just that I'm working too hard. I don't know. I'd like to get an MRI to be sure. I think we should get x-rays first, she said. MRIs for back pain are expensive and unnecessary imaging has lately become a major national point of cost-saving emphasis. But the value of a scan also depends on what you are looking for. X-rays are largely useless for cancer. Still, for many docs, ordering an MRI at this early stage is apostasy. She continued, X-rays aren't perfectly sensitive, but it makes sense to start there. How about we get Flexon extension X-rays? Then maybe the more realistic diagnosis here is ischemic spondylolisthesis. From the reflection on the wall mirror, I could see her Googling it. It's a pars fracture affecting up to 5% of people and a frequent cause of back pain in the young. Okay, I'll order them then. Thanks, I said. Why was I so authoritative in a surgeon's coat, but so meek in a patient's gown? The truth was, I knew more about back pain than she did. Half of my training as a neurosurgeon had involved disorders of the spine. But maybe a spondy was more likely. It did affect a significant percent of young adults. And cancer in the spine in your 30s. The odds of that couldn't be more than 1 in 10,000. Even if it were 100 times more common than that, it'd still be less common than a spondy. Maybe I was just freaking myself out. The x-rays looked fine. We chalked the symptoms up to hard work and an aging body, scheduled a follow-up appointment, and I went back to finish my last case of the day. The weight loss slowed, and the back pain became tolerable. A healthy dose of ibuprofen got me through the day, and after all, there weren't that many of these grueling 14-hour days left. My journey from medical student to professor of neurosurgery was almost complete. After 10 years of relentless training, I was determined to persevere for the next 15 months until residency ended. I had earned the respect of my seniors, won prodigious national awards, and was fielding job offers from several major universities. My program director at Stanford had recently sat me down and said, "Paul, I think you'll be the number one candidate for any job you apply for." Just as an FYI, We'll be starting a faculty search for someone like you here. No promises, of course, but it's something you should consider. At age 36, I had reached the mountaintop. I could see the promised land from Gilead to Jericho to the Mediterranean Sea. I could see a nice catamaran on that sea that Lucy, our hypothetical children, and I would take out on weekends. I could see the tension in my back unwinding as my work schedule eased and life became more manageable. I could see myself finally becoming the husband I'd promised to be. Then, a few weeks later, I began having bouts of severe chest pain. Had I bumped into something at work? Cracked a rib somehow? Some nights I'd wake up on soaked sheets, dripping sweat. My weight began dropping again, more rapidly now, from 175 to 145 pounds. I developed a persistent cough. Little doubt remained. One Sunday afternoon, Lucy and I were lying in the sun in Dolores Park in San Francisco, waiting to meet her sister. She glimpsed my phone screen, which displayed medical database search results. Frequency of cancer in 30 to 40-year-old. "What?" she said. "I didn't realize you were actually worried about this." I didn't respond. I didn't know what to say. "Do you want to tell me about it?" she asked. She was upset because she had been worried about it, too. She was upset because I wasn't talking to her about it. She was upset because I'd promised her one life and given her another. "Can you please tell me why you aren't confiding in me?" she asked. I turned off my phone. "Let's get some ice cream," I said. We were scheduled for a vacation the following week to visit some old college friends in New York. Maybe a good night's sleep and a few cocktails would help us reconnect a bit and decompress the pressure cooker of our marriage. But Lucy had another plan. "I'm not coming to New York with you," she announced a few days before the trip. She was going to move out for a week. She wanted time to consider the state of our marriage. She spoke in even tones which only heightened the vertigo I felt. "What?" I said, "No." "I love you so much, which is why this is so confusing," she said. "But I'm worried. We want different things from our relationship. I feel like we're connected halfway. I don't want to learn about your worries by accident. When I talk to you about feeling isolated, you don't seem to think it's a problem. I need to do something different." "Things are going to be okay," I said. "It's just residency." "Were things really so bad? Neurosurgical training, almost the most rigorous and demanding of all medical specialties, had surely put a strain on our marriage. There were so many nights when I came home from work after Lucy had gone to bed and collapsed on the living room floor, exhausted, and so many mornings when I left for work in the early dark before she'd awoken. But our careers were peaking now. Most universities wanted both of us, me in neurosurgery, Lucy in internal medicine. We'd survived the most difficult part of our journey. Hadn't we discussed this a dozen times? Didn't she realize this was the worst possible time for her to blow things up? Didn't she see that I had only 1 year left in residency, that I loved her, that we were so close to the life together we'd always wanted? "If it were just residency, I could make it," she said. "We've made it this far, but the problem is, what if it's not just residency? Do you really think things will be better when you're an academic neurosurgery attending?" I offered to skip the trip, to be more open, to see the couple therapists Lucy had suggested a few months ago, but she insisted that she needed time, alone. At that point, the fuzziness of the confusion dissipated, leaving only a hard edge. Fine, I said. If she decided to leave, then I would assume the relationship was over. If it turned out that I had cancer, I wouldn't tell her. She'd be free to live whatever life she chose. Before leaving for New York, I snuck in a few medical appointments to rule out some common cancers in the young. Testicular? No. Melanoma? No. Leukemia? No. The neurosurgical service was busy as always. Thursday night slipped into Friday morning as I was caught in the operating room for 36 hours straight. In a series of deeply complex cases, giant aneurysms, intracerebral arterial bypasses, arteriovenous malformations, I breathed a silent thanks when the attending came in, allowing me a few minutes to ease my back against the wall. The only time to get a chest x-ray was as I was leaving the hospital, on the way home before heading to the airport. I figured either I had cancer, in which case this might be the last time I would see my friends, or I didn't, in which case there would be no reason to cancel the trip. I rushed home to grab my bags. Lucy drove me to the airport and told me she had scheduled us into couples therapy. From the gate, I sent her a text message. I wish you were here. A few minutes later, the response came back. I love you. I will be here when you get back. My back stiffened terribly during the flight, and by the time I made it to Grand Central to catch a train to my friend's place upstate, my body was rippling with pain. Over the past few months, I'd had back spasms of varying frequency, from simple, ignorable pain to pain that made me forsake speech to grind my teeth, to pain so severe I curled up on the floor screaming. This pain was toward the more severe end of the spectrum. I lay down on a hard bench in the waiting area, feeling my back muscles contort, breathing to control the pain. The ibuprofen wasn't touching this, and naming each muscle as its spasm to stave off tears, erector spinae, rhomboid, latissimus piriformis. The security guard approached. Sir, you can't lie down there. I'm sorry, I said, gasping out the words. Bad back. You still can't lay down there. I'm sorry, but I'm dying from cancer. The words lingered on my tongue, but what if I wasn't? Maybe this was just what people with back pain lived with. I knew a lot about back pain, its anatomy, its physiology, the different words patients used to describe different kinds of pain. But I didn't know what it felt like. Maybe that's all this was. Maybe, or maybe I didn't want the jinx. Maybe I just didn't want to say the word cancer out loud. I pulled myself up and hobbled to the platform. It was late afternoon when I reached the house in Cold Springs, 50 miles north of Manhattan, on the Hudson River, and was greeted by a dozen of my closest friends from years past. Their cheers of welcome mixed with the cacophony of young, happy children. Hugs ensued, and an ice-cold dark and stormy made its way to my hand. No, Lucy? Sudden work things, I said, very last minute. Oh, what a bummer. Say, do you mind if I put my bags down and rest a bit? I had hoped a few days out of the OR with adequate sleep, rest, and relaxation, and short a taste of a normal life, would bring my symptoms back into the normal spectrum for back pain and fatigue. But after a day or two, it was clear there would be no reprieve. I slept through breakfasts and shambled to the lunch table to stare at ample plates of cassoulet and crab legs that I couldn't bring myself to eat. By dinner, I was exhausted, ready for bed again. Sometimes I read to the kids, but mostly they played on and around me, leaping and yelling. Kids, I think Uncle Paul needs a rest. Why don't you play over there? I remember a day off as a summer camp counselor 15 years prior, sitting on the shore of a lake in Northern California, with a bunch of joyous kids using me as an obstacle in a convoluted game of capture the flag while I read a book called Death and Philosophy. I used to laugh at the incongruities of that moment, a 20-year-old amid the splendor of trees, lakes, mountains, the chirping of birds mixed with the squeal of happy 4-year-olds, his nose buried in a small black book about death. Only now, in this moment, I felt the parallels. Instead of Lake Tahoe, it was the Hudson River. The children were not strangers, but my friends. Instead of a book on death separating me from the life around me, it was my own body dying. On the third night, I spoke to Mike, our host, to tell him I was going to cut the trip short and head home the next day. You don't look so great, he said. Everything okay? Why don't we grab some scotch and have a seat, I said. In front of his fireplace, I said, Mike, I think I have cancer, and not the good kind either. It was the first time I said it out loud. Okay, he said, I take this is not some elaborate practical joke. No. He paused. I don't know exactly what to say. Well, I suppose first I should say that I don't know for a fact that I have cancer. I'm just pretty sure of it. A lot of the symptoms point that way. I'm going to go home tomorrow and sort it out. Hopefully, I'm wrong. Mike offered to take my luggage and send it home by mail so I wouldn't have to carry it with me. He drove me to the airport early the next morning, and 6 hours later I landed in San Francisco. My phone rang as I stepped off the plane. It was my primary care doctor calling with the chest X-ray results. My lungs, instead of being clear, looked blurry, as if the camera aperture had been left open too long. The doctor said she wasn't sure what that meant. She likely knew what it meant. I knew. Lucy picked me up from the airport, but I waited until we were home to tell her. We sat on the couch, and when I told her she knew, she leaned her head on my shoulder, and a distance between us vanished. I need you, I whispered. I will never leave you, she said. We called a close friend, one of the attending neurosurgeons at the hospital, and asked him to admit me. I received the plastic arm bracelet all patients wear, put on the familiar light blue hospital gown, walked past the nurses I knew by name, and was checked into a room. The same room where I had seen hundreds of patients over the years. In this room, I had sat with patients and explained terminal diagnoses and complex operations. In this room, I had congratulated patients on being cured of a disease and seen their happiness at being returned to their lives. In this room, I had pronounced patients dead. I had sat in the chairs, washed my hands in the sink, scrawled instructions on the marker board, changed the calendar. I had even, in moments of utter exhaustion, longed to lie down in this bed and sleep. Now I lay there, wide awake. A young nurse, one I hadn't met, poked her head in. The doctor will be in soon. And with that, the future I had imagined, the one just about to be realized, the culmination of decades of striving, evaporated. We have come to the end of the prologue of When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. Part 1, In Perfect Health, I Begin. The hand of the Lord was upon me and carried me out in the Spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of the valley which was full of bones and caused me to pass by them round about. And behold, there were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? That's from Ezekiel. Chapter 37, King James Translation. I knew with certainty that I would never be a doctor. I stretched out in the sun, relaxing on a desert plateau just above our house. My uncle, a doctor, like so many of my relatives, had asked me earlier that day what I planned to do for a career. Now that I was heading off to college, and the question barely registered. If you had forced me to answer, I suppose I would have said a writer, but frankly thoughts of any career at this point seemed absurd. I was leaving this small Arizona town in a few weeks, and I felt less like someone preparing to climb a career ladder than a buzzing electron about to achieve escape velocity, flinging out into a strange and sparkling universe. I lay there in the dirt, awash in sunlight and memory, feeling the shrinking size of this town of 15,600 miles from my new college dormitory at Stanford and all its promise. I knew medicine only by its absence, specifically the absence of a father growing up, one who went to work before dawn and returned in the dark to a plate of reheated dinner. When I was 10, my father had moved us, three boys, ages 14, 10, and 8, from Bronxville, New York, a compact, affluent suburb just north of Manhattan, to Kingman, Arizona, in a desert valley ringed by two mountain ranges, known primarily to the outside world as a place to get gas en route to somewhere else. He was drawn by the sun, by the cost of living. How else would he pay for his sons to attend the colleges he aspired to, and by the opportunity to establish a regional cardiology practice of his own? His unyielding dedication to his patients soon made him a respected member of the community. When we did see him, late at night or on weekends, he was an amalgam of sweet affectations and austere diktats, hugs and kisses mixed with stony pronouncements. It's very easy to be number one. Find the guy who is number one and score 1 point higher than he does. He had reached some compromise in his mind that fatherhood could be distilled, short, concentrated, but sincere, bursts of high intensity could equal whatever it was that other fathers did. All I knew was, if that was the price of medicine, it was simply too high. From my desert plateau, I could see our house just beyond the city limits, at the base of the Serbet Mountains, amid red rock deserts speckled with mesquite, tumbleweeds, and paddle-shaped cacti. Out here, dust devils swirled up from nothing, blurring your vision, then disappeared. Spaces stretched on, then fell away into the distance. Our two dogs, Max and Nip, never grew tired of the freedom. Every day they'd venture forth and bring home some new desert treasure, the leg of a deer, unfinished bits of jackrabbit to eat later, the sun-bleached skull of a horse, the jawbone of a coyote. My friends and I loved the freedom, too, and we spent our afternoons exploring, walking, scavenging for bones in rare desert creeks. Having spent my previous years in a lightly forested suburb in the northeast, with a tree-lined main street and a candy store, I found the wild, windy desert alien and alluring. On my first trek alone, as a 10-year-old, I discovered an old irrigation grate. I pried it open with my fingers, lifted it up, and there, a few inches from my face, were three white silken webs, and in each, marching along on spindled legs, was a glistening black bulbous body bearing in its shine the dreaded blood-red hourglass. Near to each spider, a pale, pulsating sac breathed with the imminent birth of countless more black widows. Horror let the grate crash shut. I stumbled back. The horror came in the mix of country facts. Nothing is more deadly than the bite of the black widow spider, and the inhuman posture, and the black shine, and the red hourglass. I had nightmares for years. The desert offered a pantheon of terrors. Tarantulas, wolf spiders, fiddlebacks, bark scorpions, whip scorpions, centipedes, diamondbacks, sidewinders, Mojave greens. Eventually, we grew familiar, even comfortable with these creatures. For fun, when my friends and I discovered a wolf spider's nest, we'd drop an ant onto its outer limits and watch as its entangled escape attempts sent quivers down the silk strands into the spider's dark central hold, anticipating that fatal moment when the spider would burst from its hollows and seize the doomed ant in its mandibles. Country facts became my term for the rural cousin of the urban legend. As I first learned them, country facts granted fairy powers to desert creatures, making, say, the Gila monster no less an actual monster than the Gorgon. Only after living out in the desert for a while did we realize that some country facts, like the existence of the jackalope, had been deliberately created to confuse city folk and amuse the locals. I once spent an hour convincing a group of exchange students from Berlin that, yes, there was a particular species of coyote that lived inside cacti and could leap 10 yards to attack its prey, like, well, unsuspecting Germans. Yet no one precisely knew where the truth lay amid the whirling sand. For every country fact that seemed preposterous, there is one that felt solid and true. Always check your shoes for scorpions, for example, seemed plain good sense. When I was 16, I was supposed to drive my younger brother, Jivan, to school. One morning, as usual, I was running late, and as Jivan was standing impatiently in the foyer, yelling that he didn't want to get detention again because of my tardiness, so could I please hurry the hell up? I raced down the stairs, threw open the front door, and nearly stepped on a snoozing 6-foot rattlesnake. It was another country fact that if you killed a rattlesnake on your doorstep, its mate and offspring would come and make a permanent nest there, like Grendel's mother seeking her revenge. So Jivan and I drew straws. The lucky one grabbed a shovel, the unlucky one a pair of thick gardening gloves and a pillowcase, and through a serial comic dance, we managed to get the snake into the pillowcase. Then, like an Olympic hammer thrower, I hurled the hole out into the desert, with plans to retrieve the pillowcase later that afternoon so as not to get in trouble with our mother. Of our many childhood mysteries, chief among them was not why our father decided to bring his family to the desert town of Kingman, Arizona, which we grew to cherish, but how he ever convinced my mother to join him there. They had eloped, in love, across the world, from southern India to New York City, he a Christian, she a Hindu. Their marriage was condemned on both sides and led to years of familial rifts. My mother's mother never acknowledged my name, Paul, instead insisting I be called by my middle name, Suhir, to Arizona, where my mother was forced to confront an intractable mortal fear of snakes. Even the smallest, cutest, most harmless red racer would send her screaming into the house, where she'd lock the doors and arm herself with the nearest large sharp implement, rake, cleaver, axe. The snakes were a constant source of anxiety, but it was her children's future that my mother feared for most of all. Before we moved, my older brother Suman had nearly completed high school in Westchester County, where elite colleges were the expectation. He was accepted to Stanford shortly after arriving in Kingman and left the house soon thereafter. But Kingman, we learned, was not Westchester. As my mother surveyed the Mojave County public school system, she became distraught. The U.S. Census had recently identified Kingman as the least educated district in America. The high school dropout rate was somewhere north of 30%. Few students went on to college, and certainly none to Harvard, my father's standard of excellence. Looking for advice, my mother called her friends and relatives from wealthy East Coast suburbs and found some sympathetic, others gleeful that their children no longer had to compete with the suddenly educated, starved Kalanithis. At night, she broke into tears, sobbing alone in her bed. My mother, afraid the impoverished school system would hobble her children, acquired from somewhere a college prep reading list. Trained in India to be a psychologist, married at 23, and preoccupied with raising three kids in a country that was not her own, she had not read many of the books on the list herself. But she would make sure that her children were not deprived. She made me read 1984 when I was 10 years old. I was scandalized by the sex, but it also instilled in me a deep love of and care for language. Endless books and authors followed as we worked our way methodically down the list: The Count of Monte Cristo, Edgar Allan Poe, Robinson Crusoe, Ivanhoe, Gogol, The Last of the Mohicans, Dickens, Twain, Austen's, Billy Budd. By the time I was 12, I was picking them out myself, and my brother Suman was sending me the books he had read in college: The Prince, Don Quixote, Candide, La Mort d'Arthur, Beowulf, Thoreau, Sartre, Camus. Some left more of a mark than others. Brave New World founded my nascent moral philosophy and became the subject of my college admissions essay, in which I argued that happiness was not the point of life. Hamlet bore me a thousand times through the usual adolescent crises. To his coy mistress and other romantic poems led me and my friends on various joyful misadventures throughout high school. We often sneaked out at night to, for example, sing American Pie beneath the window of the captain of the cheerleading team. Her father was a local minister, and so, we reasoned, less likely to shoot. After I was caught returning at dawn from one such late-night escapade, my worried mother thoroughly interrogated me regarding every drug teenagers take, never suspecting that the most intoxicating thing I'd experienced, by far, was the volume of romantic poetry she handed me the previous week. Books became my closest confidants, finely grounded lenses providing new views of the world. In her quest to see that her children were educated, my mom drove us more than 100 miles north to the nearest big city, Las Vegas, so we could take our PSATs, SATs, and ACTs. She joined the school board, rallied teachers, and demanded that AP classes be added to the curriculum. She was a phenom. She took it upon herself to transform the Kingman school system, and she did. Suddenly, there was a feeling in our high school that the two mountain ranges that bounded the town no longer defined the horizon it was that lay beyond them. Senior year, my close friend Leo, our salutatorian and the poorest kid I knew, was advised by the school guidance counselor, "You're smart. You should join the Army." He told me about it afterwards. "Fuck that," he said. "If you're going to Harvard or Yale or Stanford, then I am too." I don't know if I was happier when I got into Stanford or when Leo got into Yale. Summer passed, and since Stanford began classes a month later than every other school, all of my friends scattered, leaving me behind. Most afternoons, I'd trek into the desert alone and nap and think until my girlfriend, Abigail, got off her shift at Kingman's Lone Coffee Shop. The desert offered a shortcut, through the mountains and down into town, and hiking was more fun than driving. Abigail was in her early 20s. A student at Scripps College, who wanted to avoid loans, was taking a semester off to stockpile tuition money. I was taken with her worldliness, the sense that she knew secrets one only learned at college. She had studied psychology, and we'd often meet as she got off work. She was a harbinger of the sub rosa, the new world awaiting me in just a few weeks. One afternoon, I awoke from my nap, looked up and saw vultures circling, mistaking me for carrion. I checked my watch. It was almost 3. I was going to be late. I dusted off my jeans and jogged the rest of the way through the desert until sand gave way to pavement. The first buildings appeared, and I rounded the corner to find Abigail, broom in hand, sweeping the coffee shop deck. "I already cleaned the espresso machine," she said, "so no iced latte for you today." The floors swept. We went inside. Abigail walked to the cash register and picked up a paperback she'd stashed there. "Here," she said, tossing it to me. "You should read this. You're always reading such high culture crap. Why don't you try something lowbrow for once?" It was a 500-page novel called Satan, His Psychotherapy and Cure by the Unfortunate Dr. Kassler, JSPS by Jeremy Levin. I took it home and read it in a day. It wasn't high culture. It should have been funny, but it wasn't. However, it did make the throwaway assumption that the mind was simply the operation of the brain, an idea that struck me with force. It started my naive understanding of the world. Of course, it must be true. What were our brains doing otherwise? Though we had free will, we were also biological organisms. The brain was an organ subject to all the laws of physics, too. Literature provided a rich account of human meaning. The brain, then, was the machinery that somehow enabled it. It seemed like magic. That night in my room, I opened up my Red Stanford course catalog, which I had read through dozens of times, and grabbed a highlighter in addition to all the literature classes I had marked. I began looking in biology and neuroscience as well. A few years later, I hadn't thought much more about a career, but had nearly completed degrees in English literature and human biology. I was driven less by achievement than by trying to understand, in earnest, what makes human life meaningful. I still felt literature provided the best account of the life of the mind, while neuroscience laid down the most elegant rules of the brain. Meaning, while a slippery concept seemed inextricable from human relationships and moral values, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland resonated profoundly, relating meaningless and isolation and the desperate quest for human connection. I found Eliot's metaphors leaking into my own language. Other authors resonated as well. Nabokov, for his awareness of how suffering can make us callous to the obvious sufferings of another. Conrad, for his hyper-tuned sense of how miscommunication between people can so profoundly impact their lives. Literature not only illuminated another's experience, it provided, I believe, the richest material for moral reflection. My brief forays into the formal ethics of analytic philosophy felt dry as a bone, missing the messiness and weight of real human life. Throughout college, my monastic, scholarly study of human meaning would conflict with my urge to forge and strengthen the human relationships that formed that meaning. If the unexamined life was not worth living, was the unlived life worth examining? Heading into my sophomore year, I applied for two jobs as an intern at the highly scientific Yerkes Primary Research Center in Atlanta and as a prep chef at Sierra Camp, a family vacation spot for Stanford alumni on the pristine shores of Fallen Lake Leaf, abutting the stark beauty of Desolation Wilderness in El Dorado National Forest. The camp's literature promised, simply, the best summer of your life. I was surprised and flattered to be accepted, yet I had just learned that McKay's have a rudimentary form of culture, and I was eager to go to Yerkes and see what could be the natural origin of meaning itself. In other words, I could either study meaning or I could experience it. After delaying as long as possible, I finally chose the camp. Afterward, I dropped by my biology advisor's office to inform him of my decision. When I walked in, he was sitting at his desk, head in a journal as usual. He was a quiet, amiable man with heavy-lidded eyes, but as I told him my plans, he became a different person entirely. His eyes opened up, and his face flushed red, flecks of spit spraying. "What?" he said. "When you grow up, are you going to be a scientist or a chef? Eventually, the term ended, and I was on the windy mountain road to camp, still slightly worried that I had made a wrong turn in my life. My doubt, however, was short-lived. The camp delivered on its promise, concentrating all the ills of youth. Beauty manifests in lakes, mountains, people. Richness in experience, conversation, friendships. Nights, during a full moon, the light flooded the wilderness, so it was possible to hike without a headlamp. We would hit the trail at 2 a.m., summiting the nearest peak, Mount Talek, just before sunrise. The clear, starry night reflected in the flat, still lakes spread below us. Snuggled together in sleeping bags at the peak nearly 10,000 feet up, we weathered frigid blasts of wind with coffee someone had been thoughtful enough to bring. And then we would sit and watch as the first hint of sunlight, a light tinge of day blue, would leak out of the eastern horizon, slowly erasing the stars. The day sky would spread wide and high until the first rays of the sun made an appearance. The morning commuters began to animate the distant South Lake Tahoe roads. But craning your head back, you could see the day's blue darken halfway across the sky, and to the west the night remained yet unconquered, pitch black, stars in full glimmer, the full moon still pinned in the sky. To the east, the full light of day beamed toward you. To the west, night reigned with no hint of surrender. No philosopher can explain the sublime better than this, standing between day and night. It was as if there were the moment God said, "Let there be light." You could not help but feel your speck-like existence against the immensity of the mountain, the earth, the universe, and yet still feel your own 2 feet on the talus, reaffirming your presence amid the grandeur. This was summer at Sierra Camp, perhaps no different from any other camp, but every day felt full of life and of the relationships that give life meaning. Other nights found a group of us on the dining room deck sipping whiskey with the assistant director of the camp, Mo, a Stanford alum, taking a break from his English PhD, and discussing literature and the weighty matters of post-adolescent life. The next year, he returned to his PhD, and later he sent me his first published short story, summing up our time together. Suddenly, now I know what I want. I want the counselors to build a pyre, and let my ashes drop and mingle with the sand. Loose my bones amongst the driftwood, my teeth amongst the sand. I don't believe in the wisdom of children nor in the wisdom of the old. There is a moment, a cusp, when the sum of gathered experience is worn down by the details of living. We are never so wise as when we live in this moment. Back on campus, I didn't miss the monkeys. Life felt rich and full, and over the next 2 years, I kept at it, seeking a deeper understanding of a life of the mind. I studied literature and philosophy to understand what makes life meaningful, studied neuroscience, and worked in an MRI lab to understand how the brain could give rise to an organism capable of finding meaning in the world, and enriched my relationships with a circle of dear friends through various escapades. We raided the school cafeteria dressed as Mongols, created a full fake fraternity, complete with fake Rush Week events in our co-op house, posed in front of the gates at Buckingham Palace in a gorilla suit, broke into Memorial Church at midnight to lie on our backs and listen to our voices echo in the apse, and so on. Then I learned that Virginia Woolf once boarded a battleship dressed as an Abyssinian royalty and duly chastised, stopped boasting about our trivial pranks. Senior year, in one of my last neuroscience classes on neuroscience and ethics, we visited a home for people who had suffered severe brain injuries. We walked into the main reception area and were greeted by a disconsolate wailing. Our guide, a friendly 30-something woman, introduced herself to the group, but my eyes hunted for the source of the noise. Behind the reception counter was a large screen television showing a soap opera on mute. A blue-eyed brunette with well-coiffed hair, her head shaking slightly with emotion, filled the screen as she pleaded with someone off camera. Zoom out, and there was her strong-jawed, undoubtedly gravel-voiced lover. They embraced passionately. The wailing rose in pitch. I stepped closer to peer over the counter, and there, on a blue mat, in front of the television, in a plain flowered print dress, was a young woman, maybe 20, her hands balled into fists pressing into her eyes, violently rocking back and forth, wailing and wailing. As she rocked, I caught glimpses of the back of her head, where her hair had worn away, leaving a large, pale patch of skin. I stepped back to join the group, which was leaving to tour the facility. Talking with the guide, I learned that many of the residents had nearly drowned as young children. Looking around, I noticed there were no other visitors besides us. Was that common? I asked. At first, the guide explained, a family will visit constantly, daily or even twice a day. Then maybe every other day. Then just weekends. After months or years, the visits taper off until it's just, say, birthdays and Christmas. Eventually, most families move away as far as they can get. I don't blame them, she said. It's hard caring for these kids. A fury churned in me. Hard? Of course it was hard. But how could parents abandon these kids? In one room, the patients lay on cots, mostly still, arranged in neat rows like soldiers in a barracks. I walked down a row until I made eye contact with one of them. She was in her late teens with dark, tangled hair. I paused and tried smiling at her, showing her I cared. I picked up one of her hands. It was limp, but she gurgled and, looking right at me, smiled. I think she's smiling, I said to the attendant. Could be, she said. It can be hard to tell sometimes, but I was sure of it. She was smiling. When we got back to campus, I was the last one left in the room with the professor. So, what do you think? He asked. I vented openly about how I couldn't believe that parents had abandoned these poor kids and how one of them had even smiled at me. The professor was a mentor, someone who thought deeply about how science and mortality intersected. I expected him to agree with me. Yeah, he said. Good. Good for you. But sometimes, you know, I think it's better if they die. I grabbed my bag and left. She had been smiling, hadn't she? Only later would I realize that our trip had added a new dimension to my understanding of the fact that brains give rise to our ability to form relationships and make life meaningful. Sometimes they break. As graduation loomed, I had a nagging sense that there was still far too much unresolved for me, that I wasn't done studying. I applied for a master's in English literature at Stanford and was accepted into the program. I had come to see language as an almost supernatural force existing between people, bringing our brains, shielded in centimeters-thick skulls, into communion. A word meant something only between people, and life's meaning, its virtues, had something to do with the depth of the relationships we form. It was the relational aspect of humans, that is, human rationality, that undergirded meaning, yet somehow this process existed in brains and bodies, subject to their own physiologic imperatives, prone to breaking and failing. There must be a way, I thought, that the language of life as experienced, of passion, of hunger, of love, bore some relationship, however convoluted, to the language of neurons, digestive tracts, and heartbeats. At Stanford, I had the good fortune to study with Richard Rorty, perhaps the greatest living philosopher of his day, and under his tutelage. I began to see all disciplines as creating a vocabulary, a set of tools for understanding human life in a particular way. Great literary works provided their own set of tools, compelling the reader to use that vocabulary. For my thesis, I studied the work of Walt Whitman, a poet who, a century before, was possessed by the same questions that haunted me, who wanted to find a way to understand and describe what he termed the physiological spiritual man. As I finished my thesis, I could only conclude that Whitman had had no better luck than the rest of us at building a coherent physiological spiritual vocabulary, but at least the ways in which he failed were illuminating. I was also increasingly certain that I had little desire to continue in literary studies, whose main preoccupations had begun to strike me as overly political and adverse to science. One of my thesis advisors remarked that finding a community for myself in the literary world would be difficult, because most English PhDs reacted to science, as he put it, like apes to fire, with sheer terror. I wasn't sure where my life was headed. My thesis, Whitman and the Medicalization of Personality, was well received, but it was unorthodox, including as much history of psychiatry and neuroscience as literary criticism. It didn't quite fit in an English department. I didn't quite fit in an English department. Some of my closest friends from college were headed to New York City to pursue a life in the arts, some in comedy, others in journalism and television, and I briefly considered joining them and starting anew. But I couldn't quite let go of the question. Where did biology, morality, literature, and philosophy intersect? Walking home from a football game one afternoon, the autumn breeze blowing, I let my mind wander. Augustine's voice in the garden commanded, "Take up and read," but the voice I heard commanded the opposite, "Set aside the books and practice medicine." Suddenly, it all seemed obvious, although, or perhaps because, my father, my uncle, and my elder brother were all doctors, medicine had never occurred to me as a serious possibility. But hadn't Whitman himself written that only the physician could truly understand the physiological spiritual man? The next day, I consulted a pre-med advisor to figure out the logistics. Getting ready for medical school would take about a year of intense coursework, plus the application time, which added up to another 18 months. It would mean letting my friends go to New York to continue deepening their relationships without me. It would mean setting aside literature, but it would allow me a chance to find answers that are not in books, to find a different sort of sublime, to forge relationships with the suffering, and to keep following the question of what makes human life meaningful, even in the face of death and decay. I began working through the necessary pre-medical courses, loading up on chemistry and physics. Reluctant to take a part-time job, it would slow my studies, but unable to afford Palo Alto rent, I found an open window in an empty dormitory and climbed in. After a few weeks of squatting, I was discovered by the caretaker, who happened to be a friend. She provided a key to the room and some useful warnings, like when the high school girls' cheerleading camps would be coming through. Thinking it wise to avoid becoming a registered sex offender, I packed a tent, some books, and granola, and headed up to Tahoe until it was safe to return. Because the med school application cycle takes 18 months, I had a free year once my classes were over. Several professors had suggested I pursue a degree in the history and philosophy of science and medicine before deciding to leave academia for good. So, I applied for and was accepted into the HPS program at Cambridge. I spent the next year in classrooms in the English countryside, where I found myself increasingly often arguing that direct experience of life and death question was essential to generating substantial moral opinions about them. Words began to feel as weightless as the breath that carried them. Stepping back, I realized that I was merely confirming what I already knew. I wanted that direct experience. It was only in practicing medicine that I could pursue a serious biological philosophy. Moral speculation was puny compared to moral action. I finished my degree and headed back to the States. I was going to Yale for medical school. You would think that the first time you cut up a dead person, you'd feel a bit funny about it. Strangely, though, everything feels normal. The bright lights, stainless steel tables, and bow-tied professors lend an air of propriety. Even so, that first cut, running from the nape of the neck down to the small of the back, is unforgettable. The scalpel is so sharp it doesn't so much cut the skin as unzip it, revealing the hidden and forbidden sinew beneath, and despite your preparation, you are caught unawares, ashamed, and excited. Cadaver dissection is a medical rite of passage and a trespass on the sacrosanct, engendering a legion of feelings from revulsion, exhilaration, nausea, frustration, and awe to, as time passes, a mere tedium of academic exercise. Everything teeters between pathos and bathos. Here you are violating society's most fundamental taboos, and yet formaldehyde is a powerful appetite stimulant, so you also crave a burrito. Eventually, as you complete your assignments by dissecting the median nerve, sawing the pelvis in half, and slicing open the heart, the bathos supersedes. The sacred violation takes on the character of your average college class, replete with pendants, class clowns, and the rest. Cadaver dissection epitomizes for many the transformation of the somber, respectful student into the callous, arrogant doctor. The enormity of the moral mission of medicine lent my early days of med school a severe gravity. The first day before we got to the cadavers was CPR training, my second time doing it. The first time, back in college, had been farcical, unserious, everyone laughing. The terribly acted videos and limbless plastic mannequins couldn't have been more artificial. But now, the lurking possibility that we would have to employ these skills someday animated everything. As I repeatedly slammed my palm into the chest of a tiny plastic child, I couldn't help but hear, along with my fellow students' jokes, real ribs cracking. Cadavers reverse the polarity. The mannequins you pretend are real, the cadavers you pretend are fake. But that first day, you just can't. When I faced my cadaver, slightly blue and bloated, his total deadness and total humanness were undeniable. The knowledge that in 4 months I would be bisecting this man's head with a hacksaw seemed unconscionable. Yet there are anatomy professors, and the advice they gave us was to take one good look at our cadaver's face and then leave it covered. It makes the work easier. Just as we prepared, with deep breaths and earnest looks, to unwrap our cadaver's head, a surgeon stopped by to chat, leaning with his elbow on the corpse's face. Pointing out various marks and scars on the naked torso, he reconstructed the patient's history. This scar is from an inguinal hernia operation. This one, a carotid endarterectomy. These marks here indicate scratching, possibly jaundice, high bilirubin. He probably died of pancreatic cancer, though no scars for that, killing him too quick. Meanwhile, I could not help but stare at the shifting elbows that, with each medical hypothesis and vocabulary lessons, rolled over this covered head. I thought, prosopagnosia is a neurological disorder wherein one loses the ability to see faces. Pretty soon I would have it, hacksaw in hand. Because after a few weeks, the drama dissipated. In conversations with non-medical students, telling cadaver stories, I found myself highlighting the grotesque, macabre, and absurd, as if to reassure them that I was normal, even though I was spending 6 hours a week carving up a corpse. Sometimes I told of the moment when I turned around and saw a classmate, the sort of woman who had a mug decorated with puffy paint, tiptoeing on a stool, cheerfully hammering a chisel into a woman's backbone, splinters flying through the air. I told the story as if to distance myself from it, but my kinship was undeniable. After all, hadn't I just as eagerly disassembled a man's ribcage with a pair of bolt cutters? Even working on the dead, with their faces covered, their names a mystery, you find that their humanity pops up at you. In opening my cadaver's stomach, I found 2 undigested morphine pills, meaning that he had died in pain, perhaps alone and fumbling with the cap of a pill bottle. Of course, the cadavers, in life, donated themselves freely to this fate, and the language surrounding the bodies in front of us soon changed to reflect that fact. We were instructed to no longer call them cadavers. Donors was the preferred term. And yes, the transgressive element of dissection had certainly decreased from the bad old days. Students no longer had to bring their own bodies, for starters, as they did in the 19th century, and medical schools had discontinued their support of the practice of robbing graves to procure cadavers. That looting itself, a vast improvement over murder, a means once common enough to warrant its own verb, burk, which the OED defines as, quote, to kill secretly by suffocation or strangulation, or for the purpose of selling the victim's body for dissection, unquote. Yet the best informed people, doctors, almost never donated their bodies. How informed were their donors then? As one anatomy professor put it to me, you wouldn't tell a patient the gory details of a surgery if that would make them not consent. Even if donors were informed enough, and they might well have been, Notwithstanding one anatomy professor's hedging, it wasn't so much the thought of being dissected that galled. It was the thought of your mother, your father, your grandparents being hacked to pieces by wisecracking 22-year-old medical students. Every time I read the pre-lab and saw a term like bone saw, I wondered if this would be the session in which I finally vomited. Yet I was rarely troubled in lab, even when I found that the bone saw in question was nothing more than a common rusty wood saw. The closest I ever came to vomiting was nowhere near the lab, but on a visit to my grandmother's grave in New York on the 20th anniversary of her death. I found myself doubled over, almost crying and apologizing, not to my cadaver, but to my cadaver's grandchildren. In the midst of our lab, in fact, a son requested his mother's half-dissected body back. Yes, she had consented, but he couldn't live with that. I knew I'd do the same. The remains were returned. In anatomy lab, we objectified the dead, literally reducing them to organs, tissues, nerves, muscles. On that first day, you simply could not deny the humanity of the corpse. But by the time you'd skinned the limbs, sliced through inconvenient muscles, pulled out the lungs, cut open the heart, and removed a lobe of the liver, it was hard to recognize this pile of tissue as human. Anatomy lab, in the end, becomes less a violation of the sacred and more something that interferes with happy hour and that realization discomforts. In our rare reflective moments, we were all silently apologizing to our cadavers, not because we sensed the transgression, but because we did not. It was not a simple evil, however. All of medicine, not just cadaver dissection, trespasses into sacred spheres. Doctors invade the body in every way imaginable. They see people at their most vulnerable, their most scared, their most private. They escort them into the world and then back out. Seeing the body as matter and mechanism is the flip side to easing the most profound human suffering. By the same token, the most profound human suffering becomes a mere pedagogical tool. Anatomy professors are perhaps the extreme end of this relationship, yet their kinship to the cadavers remains. Early on, when I made a long, quick cut through my donor's diaphragm in order to ease finding the splenic artery, our proctor was both livid and horrified. Not because I had destroyed an important structure, or misunderstood a key concept, or ruined a future dissection, but because I had seemed so cavalier about it. The look on his face, his inability to vocalize his sadness, taught me more about medicine than any lecture I would ever attend. When I explained that another anatomy professor had told me to make the cut, our proctor's sadness turned to rage, and suddenly red-faced professors were being dragged into the hallway. Other times, the kinship was much simpler. Once, while showing us the ruins of our donor's pancreatic cancer, the professor asked, "How old is this fellow?" 74, we replied. "That's my age," he said, set down the probe, and walked away. Medical school sharpened my understanding of the relationship between meaning, life, and death. I saw the human rationality I had written about as an undergraduate realized in the doctor-patient relationship. As medical students, we were confronted by death, suffering, and the work entitled inpatient care, while being simultaneously shielded from the real brunt of responsibility, though we could spot its specter. Med students spent the first 2 years in classrooms, socializing, studying, and reading. It was easy to treat the work as a mere extension of undergraduate studies. But my girlfriend Lucy, whom I met in the first year of medical school, and who would later become my wife, understood the subtext of the academics. Her capacity to love was barely finite, and a lesson to me. One night, on the sofa in my apartment, while studying the reams of wavy lines that made up EKGs, she puzzled over, then correctly identified, a fatal arrhythmia. All at once, it dawned on her and she began to cry. Wherever this practiced EKG had come from, the patient had not survived. The squiggly lines on that page were more than just lines. They were ventricular fibrillation deteriorating to asystole, and they could bring you to tears. Lucy and I attended the Yale School of Medicine when Shep Newland still lectured there, but I knew him only in my capacity as a reader. Newland was a renowned surgeon philosopher whose seminal book about mortality, How We Die, had come out when I was in high school, but it made it into my hands only in medical school. Few books I had read so directly and wholly addressed that fundamental fact of existence. All organisms, whether goldfish or grandchild, die. I pored over it in my room at night and remember in particular his description of his grandmother's illness and how that one passage so perfectly illuminated the ways in which the personal, medical, and spiritual all intermingle. Newland recalled how, as a child, he would play a game in which, using his finger, he indented his grandmother's skin to see how long it took to resume its shape, a part of the aging process that, along with her newfound shortness of breath, showed her gradual slide into congestive heart failure, a significant decline in the amount of oxygen that aged blood is capable of taking up from the aged tissues of the aged lung. But what was most evident, he continued, was the slow drawing away from life. By the time Bubba stopped praying, she had stopped virtually everything else as well. With her final stroke, Newland remembered Sir Thomas Browne's Religio Medici, quote, "With what strife and pains we come into the world, we know not. But 'tis commonly no easy matter to get out of it," unquote. I had spent so much time studying literature at Stanford and the history of medicine at Cambridge in an attempt to better understand the particularities of death, only to come away feeling like they were still unknowable to me. Descriptions like Newland's convinced me that such things could be known only face to face. I was pursuing medicine to bear witness to the twinned mysteries of death, its experimental and biological manifestations, at once deeply personal and utterly impersonal. I remember Newland, in the opening chapters of How We Die, writing about being a young medical student alone in the OR with a patient whose heart had stopped. In an act of desperation, he cut open the patient's chest and tried to pump his heart manually, tried to literally squeeze the life back into him. The patient died, and Newland was found by his supervisor covered in blood and failure. Medical school had changed by the time I got there, to the point where such a scene was simply unthinkable. As medical students, we were barely allowed to touch patients, let alone open their chest. What had not changed, though, was the heroic spirit of responsibility amid blood and failure. This struck me as the true image of a doctor. The first birth I witnessed was also the first death. I had recently taken step one of my medical boards, wrapping up 2 years of intensive study, buried in books deep in libraries, poring over literature notes in coffee shops, reviewing handmade flashcards while lying in bed. The next 2 years, then, I would spend in the hospital and clinic, finally putting that theoretical knowledge to use to reveal concrete suffering with patients, not abstractions, as my primary focus. I started in OBGYN, working the graveyard shift in the labor and delivery ward. Walking into the building as the sun descended, I tried to recall the stages of labor, the corresponding dilation of the cervix, the names of the stations that indicate the baby's descent, anything that might prove helpful when the time came. As a medical student, my task was to learn by observation and avoid getting in the way. Residents who had finished medical school and were now completing training in the chosen specialty, and nurses with their years of clinical experience, would serve as my primary instructors. But the fear still lurked. I could feel it fluttering, that through accident or expectation, I'd be called on to deliver a child by myself and fail. I made my way to the doctor's lounge where I was to meet the resident. I walked in and saw a dark-haired young woman lying on a couch, chomping furiously at a sandwich while watching TV and reading a journal article. I introduced myself. "Oh, hi," she said. "I'm Melissa. I'll be in here or in the call room if you need me. Probably the best thing for you to do is to keep an eye on patient Garcia. She's a 22-year-old here with preterm labor and twins. Everyone else is pretty standard." Between bites, Melissa briefed me, a barrage of facts and information. The twins were only 23 and a half weeks old. The hope was to keep the pregnancy going until they were more developed, however long that might be. 24 weeks was considered the cusp of viability, and every extra day made a difference. The patient was getting various drugs to control her contractions. Melissa's pager went off. "Okay," she said, swinging her legs off the couch. "I gotta go. You can hang out in here if you like. We have good cable channels, or you can come with me." I followed Melissa to the nurse's station. One wall was lined with monitors displaying wavy telemetry lines. "That's the output of the tachometers and the fetal heart rates. Let me show you the patient. She doesn't speak English. Do you speak Spanish?" I shook my head. Melissa brought me to the room. It was dark. The mother lay in the bed, resting, quiet, monitor bands wrapped around her belly, tracking her contractions, and the twins' heart rates, and sending the signal to the screens I'd seen at the nurses' stations. The father stood at the bedside, holding his wife's hand, worry etched on his brow. Melissa whispered something to them in Spanish, then escorted me out. For the next several hours, things progressed smoothly. Melissa slept in the lounge. I tried decoding the incipherable squibbles in Garcia's chart, which was like reading hieroglyphics, and came away with the knowledge that her first name was Elena. This was her second pregnancy. She had received no prenatal care, and she had no insurance. I wrote down the names of the drugs she was getting and made a note to look them up later. I read a little about premature labor in a textbook I found in the doctor's lounge. Preemies, if they survived, apparently incurred high rates of brain hemorrhages and cerebral palsy. Then again, my older brother, Suman, had been born almost 8 weeks premature, 3 decades earlier, and he was now a practicing neurologist. I walked over to the nurse and asked her to teach me how to read those little squiggles on the monitor, which were no clearer to me than the doctor's handwriting, but could apparently foretell calm or disaster. She nodded and began talking me through reading a contraction and the fetal heart rate's reaction to it, the way, if you look closely, you could see. She stopped. Worry flashed across her face. Without a word, she got up and ran into Elena's room, then burst back out, grabbed the phone, and paged Melissa. A minute later, Melissa arrived, bleary-eyed, glanced at the stripes, and rushed into the patient's room, with me trailing behind. She flipped open her cell phone and called the attending, rapidly talking in a jargon I only partially understood. The twins were in distress, I gathered, and their only shot at survival was an emergency C-section. I was carried along with the commotion into the operating room. They got Elena's supine on the table, drugs running into her veins, a nurse frantically painting the woman's swollen abdomen with an antiseptic solution, while the attending, the resident, and I splashed alcohol cleanser on our hands and forearms. I mimicked their urgent strokes, standing silently as they cursed under their breath. The anesthesiologist intubated the patient, while the senior surgeon, the attending, fidgeted. "Come on," he said, "we don't have a lot of time. We need to move faster." I was standing next to the attending as he sliced open the woman's belly, making a single long curvy Linacre incision beneath her belly button, just below the apex of her protuberant womb. I tried to follow every movement, digging in my brain for textbook anatomical sketches. The skin slid apart at the scalpel's touch. He sliced confidently through the tough white rectus fascia covering the muscle, then split the fascia and the underlying muscle with his hands, revealing the first glimpse of the melon-like uterus. He sliced that open as well, and a small face appeared, then disappeared amid the blood. In plunged the doctor's hands, pulling out one, then two purple babies, barely moving, eyes fused shut like tiny birds, fallen too soon from a nest. With their bones visible through translucent skin, they look more like preparatory sketches of children than children themselves. Too small to cradle, not much bigger than the surgeon's hands, they were rapidly passed to the waiting neonatal intensivist, who rushed them to the neonatal ICU. With the immediate danger averted, the pace of the operation slowed, frenzy turning to something resembling calm. The odor of burnt flesh wafted up as the cartery arrested little spurts of blood. The uterus was sutured back together, the stitches like a row of teeth, biting close the open wound. "Professor, do you want the peritoneum closed?" Melissa asked. "I read recently that it doesn't need to be." "Let no man put asunder what God has joined," the attending said. "At least no more than temporarily. I like to leave things the way I found them. Let's sew it back up." The peritoneum is a membrane that surrounds the abdominal cavity. Somehow I had completely missed its opening, and I couldn't see it at all now. To me, the wound looked like a mass of disorganized tissue, yet to the surgeons it had an applicable order, like a block of marble to a sculptor. Melissa called for the peritoneal stitch, reached her forceps into the wound, and pulled up a transparent layer of tissue between the muscle and the uterus. Suddenly the peritoneum, and the gaping hole in it, was clear. She sewed it closed and moved on to the muscle and fascia, putting them back together with a large needle and a few big looping stitches. The attending left, and finally the skin was sutured together. Melissa asked me if I wanted to place the last two stitches. My hands shook as I passed the needle through the subcutaneous tissue. As I tightened down the suture, I saw that the needle was slightly bent. The skin had come together lopsided, a glob of fat poking through. Melissa sighed. "That's uneven," she said. "You have to just catch the dermal layer. You see this thin white strip?" I did. Not only would my mind have to be trained, my eyes too. "Scissors." Melissa cut out my amateur knots, resutured the wound, applied the dressing, and the patient was taken to recovery. As Melissa told me earlier, 24 weeks in utero was considered the edge of viability. The twins had lasted 23 weeks and 6 days. Their organs were present, but perhaps not yet ready for the responsibility of sustaining life. They were owed nearly 4 more months of protected development in the womb, where oxygenated blood and nutrients came to them through the umbilical cord. Now, oxygen would have to come through the lungs, and the lungs were not capable of complex expansion and gas transfer that was respiration. I went to see them in the NICU, each twin encased in a clear plastic incubator, dwarfed by large beeping machines, barely visible amid the tangles of wires and tubes. The incubator had small side ports through which the parents could strain to reach and gently stroke a leg or arm, providing vital human contact. The sun was up. My shift was over. I was sent home. The image of the twins being extracted from the uterus interrupting my sleep, like a premature lung, I felt unready for the responsibility of sustaining life. When I returned to work that night, I was assigned to a new mother. No one anticipated problems with this pregnancy. Things were as routine as possible. Today was even her actual due date. Along with the nurse, I followed the mother's steady progress, contractions racking her body with increasing regularity. The nurse reported the dilation of the cervix from 3 centimeters to 5 to 10. "Okay, it's time to push now," the nurse said. Turning to me, she said, "Don't worry, we'll page you when the delivery is close." I found Melissa in the doctor's lounge. After some time, the OB team was called into the room. Delivery was near. Outside the door, Melissa handed me a gown, gloves, and a pair of long boot covers. "It gets messy," she said. We entered the room. I stood awkwardly off to the side until Melissa pushed me to the front between the patient's legs, just in front of the attending. "Push," the nurse encouraged. "Now again, just like that, only without the screaming." The screaming didn't stop, and was soon accompanied by a gush of blood and other fluids. The neatness of medical diagrams did nothing to represent nature, red not only in tooth and claw, but in birth as well. In Ann Geddes' photo, this was not. It was becoming clear that learning to be a doctor in practice was going to be a very different education from being a medical student in the classroom. Reading books and answering multiple-choice questions bore little resemblance to taking action, with its concomitant responsibility. Knowing you need to be judicious when pulling on the head to facilitate delivery of the shoulder is not the same as doing it. "What if I pull too hard?" "Irreversible nerve injury," my brain shouted. The head appeared with each push and then retracted with each break. 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. I waited. The human brain has rendered the organism's most basic task, reproduction, a treacherous affair. That same brain made things like labor and delivery units, cardio tachometers, epidurals, and emergency C-sections both possible and necessary. I stood still, unsure when to act or what to do. The attending's voice guided my hands to the emerging head, and on the next push I gently guided the baby's shoulder as she came out. She was large, plump, and wet, easily 3 times the size of the bird-like creatures from the previous night. Melissa clamped the cord and I cut it. The child's eyes opened and she began to cry. I held the baby a moment longer, feeling her weight and substance, then passed her to the nurse, who brought her to the mother. I walked out of the waiting room to inform the extended family of the happy news. The dozen or so family members gathered there leapt up to celebrate, a riot of handshakes and hugs. I was a prophet returning from the mountaintop with news of a joyous new covenant. All the messiness of the birth disappeared. Here I had just been holding the newest member of this family, this man's niece, this girl's cousin. Returning to the ward, ebullient, I ran into Melissa. "Hey, do you know how last night's twins are doing?" I asked. She darkened. "Baby A died yesterday afternoon. Baby B managed to live not quite 24 hours, then passed away around the time I was delivering the new baby." In that moment, I could only think of Samuel Beckett. The metaphor is that in those twins reach their terminal limit. Quote, "One day we were born, one day we shall die, the same day, the same second. Birth the strides of a grave, the light gleams an instant, Then it's night once more, unquote. I had stood next to the grave digger with his forceps. What had these lives amounted to? You think that's bad, she continued. Most mothers with stillborn still have to go through labor and deliver. Can you imagine? At least these guys had a chance. A match flickers, but does not light. The mother's waiting in room 543, the searing red rims of the father's lower eyelids, tears silently streaking his face. This flip side of joy, the unbearable, unjust, unexpected presence of death. What possible sense could be made? What words were there for comfort? Was it the right choice to do an emergency C-section, I asked. No questions, she said. It was the only shot they had. What happens if you don't? Probably they die. Abnormal fetal heart tracings show when the fetal blood is turning acidemic. The cord is compromised somehow or something else seriously bad is happening. But how do you know when the tracing looks bad enough? Which is worse, being born too early or waiting too long to deliver? Judgment call. What a call to make. In my life, had I ever made a decision harder than choosing between a French dip and a Reuben? How could I ever learn to make and live with such judgment calls? I still had a lot of practical medicine to learn, but would knowledge alone be enough? Would life and death hanging in the balance? Surely intelligence wasn't enough. Moral clarity was needed as well. Somehow, I had to believe I would gain not only knowledge, but wisdom too. After all, when I had walked into the hospital just one day before, birth and death had been merely abstract concepts. Now I had seen them both up close. Maybe Beckett's Pozo is right. Maybe life is merely an instant, too brief to consider. But my focus would have to be on my imminent role, intimately involved with the when and how of death, the gravedigger with the forceps. Not long after my OB-GYN rotation ended, and it was immediately on to surgical oncology. Marie, a fellow med student, and I would rotate together. A few weeks in, after a sleepless night, she was assigned to assist in a Whipple, a complex operation that involves rearranging most abdominal organs in an attempt to resect pancreatic cancer, an operation in which a medical student typically stands still, or at best retracts, for up to 9 hours straight. It's considered the plum operation to be selected to help with, because of its extreme complexity. Only chief residents are allowed to actively participate. But it is grueling, the ultimate test of a general surgeon's skill. 15 minutes after the operation started, I saw Marie in the hallway crying. The surgeon always begins a Whipple by inserting a small camera through a tiny incision to look for metastases, as widespread cancer renders the operation useless and causes its cancellation. Standing there, waiting in the OR with a 9-hour surgery stretching out before her, Marie had a whisper of a thought. I'm so tired. Please, God, let there be Mets. There were. The patient was sewed back up, the procedure called off. First came relief, then a gnawing, deepening shame. Marie burst out of the OR, where, needing a confessor, she saw me, and I became one. In the fourth year of medical school, I watched as one by one many of my classmates elected to specialize in less demanding areas, radiology or dermatology, for example, and applied for their residences. Puzzled by this, I gathered data from several elite medical schools and saw that the trends were the same. By the end of medical school, most students tended to focus on lifestyle specialties, those with more humane hours, higher salaries, and lower pressures. The idealism of their med school application essay tempered or lost. As graduation neared and we sat down in the Yale tradition to rewrite our commencement oath, a meddling of the words of Hippocrates, Maimonides, Osler, along with a few other great medical forefathers, several students argued for the removal of language insisting that we place our patient's interest above our own. The rest of us didn't allow this discussion to continue for long. The words stayed. This kind of egotism struck me as antithetical to medicine and, it should be noted, entirely reasonable. Indeed, this is how 99% of people select their jobs, pay, work, environment, hours. But that's the point. Putting lifestyle first is how you find a job, not a calling. As for me, I would choose neurosurgery as my specialty. The choice, which I had been contemplating for some time, was cemented one night in a room just off the OR when I listened in quiet awe as a pediatric neurosurgeon sat down with the parents of a child with a large brain tumor who had come in that night complaining of headaches. He not only delivered the clinical facts, but addressed the human facts as well, acknowledging the tragedy of the situation and providing guidance. As it happened, the child's mother was a radiologist. The tumor looked malignant. The mother had already studied the scans, and now she sat in a plastic chair under fluorescent lights, devastated. "Now, Claire," the surgeon began softly, "is it as bad as it looks?" The mother interrupted, "Do you think it's cancer?" "I don't know. What I do know, and I know you know these things too, is that your life is about to... it already has changed. This is going to be a long haul, you understand? You have got to be there for each other, but you also have to get your rest when you need it. This kind of illness can either bring you together or it can tear you apart. Now, more than ever, you have to be there for each other. I don't want either of you staying up all night at the bedside or never leaving the hospital. Okay?" He went on to describe the planned operation, the likely outcomes and possibilities, what decisions needed to be made now, what decisions they should start thinking about but didn't need to decide on immediately, and what sorts of decisions they should not worry about at all yet. By the end of the conversation, the family was not at ease, but they seemed able to face the future. I had watched the parents' faces. At first, wan, dull, almost otherworldly, sharpened in focus. And as I sat there, I realized that the questions intersecting life, death, and meaning, questions that all people face at some point, usually arise in a medical context. In the actual situations where one encounters these questions, it becomes a necessary philosophical and biological exercise. Humans are organisms, subject to physical laws, including, alas, the one that says entropy always increases. Disease are molecules misbehaving. The basic requirements of life is metabolism, and death its cessation. While all doctors treat diseases, neurosurgeons work in the crucible of identity. Every operation on the brain is, by necessity, a manipulation of the substance of ourselves, and every conversation with a patient undergoing brain surgery cannot help but confront this fact. In addition to the patient and family, the brain surgery is usually the most dramatic event that they have ever faced, and as such, has the impact of any major life event. At those critical junctures, the question is not simply whether to live or die, but what kind of life is worth living? Would you trade your ability, or your mother's, to talk for a few extra months of mute life? The expansion of your visual blind spot in exchange for eliminating the small possibility of a fatal brain hemorrhage? Your right hand's function to stop seizures? How much neurologic suffering would you let your child endure before saying that death is preferable? Because the brain mediates our experience of the world any neurosurgical problem forces a patient and family, ideally with a doctor as a guide, to answer this question: what makes life meaningful enough to go on living? I was compelled by neurosurgery with its unforgiving call to perfection. Like the ancient Greek concept, arete, I thought virtue required moral, emotional, mental, and physical excellence. Neurosurgery seemed to present the most challenging and direct confrontation with meaning, identity, and death. Concomitant with the enormous responsibilities they shouldered, neurosurgeons were also masters of many fields: neurosurgery, ICU medicine, neurology, radiology. Not only would I have to train my mind and hands, I realized, I'd have to train my eyes and perhaps other organs as well. The idea was overwhelming and intoxicating. Perhaps I too could join the ranks of these polymaths who strode into the densest thicket of emotional, scientific, and spiritual problems and found, or carved, ways out. After medical school, Lucy and I, newly married, headed to California to begin our residences. Me at Stanford, Lucy just up the road at UCSF, that's University of California, San Francisco. Medical school was officially behind us. Now real responsibility lay in wait. In short order, I made several close friends in the hospital, in particular Victoria, my co-resident, and Jeff, a general surgery resident, a few years senior to us. Over the next 7 years of training, we would grow from bearing witness to medical dramas to becoming leading actors in them. As an intern in the first year of residency, one is little more than a paper pusher against a backdrop of life and death, though even then, the workload is enormous. My first day in the hospital, the chief resident said to me, "Neurosurgery residents aren't just the best surgeons, we're the best doctors in the hospital. That's your goal. Make us proud." The chairman, passing through the ward, "Always eat with your left hand. You've got to be ambidextrous." One of the senior residents, "Just a heads up, the chief is going through a divorce, so he's really throwing himself into his work right now. Don't make any small talk with him." The outgoing intern, who was supposed to orient me but instead just handed me a list of 43 patients. "The only thing I have to tell you is they can always hurt you more, but they can't stop the clock." And then he walked away. I didn't leave the hospital for the first 2 days, but before long, the impossible-seeming day-killing mounds of paperwork were only an hour's work. Still, when you work in a hospital, the papers you file aren't just papers. They are fragments of narratives filled with risks and triumphs. An 8-year-old named Matthew, for example, came in one day complaining of headaches only to learn that he had a tumor abutting his hypothalamus. The hypothalamus regulates our basic drives, sleep, hunger, thirst, sex. Leaving any tumor behind would subject Matthew to a life of radiation, further surgeries, brain catheters. In short, it would consume his childhood. Complete removal could prevent that, but at the risk of damaging his hypothalamus, rendering him a slave to his appetites. The surgeon got to work, passed a small endoscope through Matthew's nose, and drilled off the floor of his skull. Once inside, he saw a clear plane and removed the tumor. A few days later, Matthew was bopping around the ward, sneaking candies from the nurses, ready to go home. That night, I happily filled out the endless pages of his discharge paperwork. I lost my first patient on a Tuesday. She was an 82-year-old woman, small and trim, the healthiest person on the general surgery service, where I spent a month as an intern. At her autopsy, the pathologist would be shocked to learn her age. She has the organs of a 50-year-old. She had been admitted for constipation from a mild bowel obstruction. After 6 days of hoping her bowels would untangle themselves, we did a minor operation to help sort things out. Around 8 p.m. Monday night, I stopped by to check on her, and she was alert, doing fine. As we talked, I pulled from my pocket my list of the day's work and crossed off the last item. Post-op check, Mrs. Harvey. It was time to go home and get some rest. Sometime after midnight, the phone rang. The patient was crashing. With the complacency of bureaucratic work suddenly torn away, I sat up in bed and spat out orders. 1 liter bolus of LR, EKG, chest x-ray, stat. I'm on the way in. I called my chief, and she told me to add labs and call her back when I had a better sense of things. I sped to the hospital and found Mrs. Harvey struggling for air, her heart racing, her blood pressure collapsing. She wasn't getting better no matter what I did, and as I was the only general surgery intern on call, my pager was buzzing relentlessly with calls I could dispense with. Patients needing sleep medication, and ones I couldn't, a ruptured aortic aneurysm in the ER. I was drowning, out of my depth, pulled in a thousand directions, and Mrs. Harvey was still not improving. I arranged a transfer to the ICU, where we blasted her with drugs and fluids to keep her from dying, and I spent the next few hours running between my patient threatening to die in the ER and my patient actively dying in the ICU. By 5:45 a.m., the patient in the ER was on his way to the OR, and Mrs. Harvey was relatively stable. She needed 12 liters of fluid, 2 units of blood, a ventilator, and 3 different pressors to stay alive. When I finally left the hospital at 5 p.m. on Tuesday evening, Mrs. Harvey wasn't getting better or worse. At 7 p.m., the phone rang. Mrs. Harvey had coded, and the ICU team was attempting CPR. I raced back to the hospital, and once again, she pulled through. Barely. This time, instead of going home, I grabbed dinner near the hospital just in case. At 8 p.m., my phone rang. Mrs. Harvey had died. I went home to sleep. I was somewhere between angry and sad. For whatever reason, Mrs. Harvey had burst through the layers of paperwork to become my patient. The next day, I attended her autopsy, watching the pathologist open her up and remove her organs. I inspected them myself, ran my hands over them, checked the knots I had tied in her intestines. From that point on, I resolved to treat all my paperwork as patients, and not vice versa. In that first year, I would glimpse my share of death. I sometimes saw it while peeking around corners, other times while feeling embarrassed to be caught in the same room. Here were a few of the people I saw die. 1. An alcoholic, his blood no longer able to clot, who bled to death into his joints and under his skin. Every day the bruises would spread. Before he became delirious, he looked up at me and said, "It's not fair. I've been diluting my drinks with water." 2. A pathologist, dying of pneumonia, wheezing her death rattle before heading down to be autopsied, her final trip to the pathology lab where she had spent so many years of her life. 3. A man who'd had a minor neurosurgical procedure to treat lightning bolts of pain that were shooting through his face. A tiny drop of liquid cement had been placed on the suspected nerve to keep a vein from pressing on it. A week later, he developed massive headaches. Nearly every test was run, but no diagnosis was ever identified. 4. Dozens of cases of head trauma, suicides, gunshots, bar fights, motorcycle accidents, car crashes, a moose attack. At moments, the weight of it all became palpable. It was in the air, the stress and misery. Normally, you breathe it in. without noticing it. But some days, like a humid, muggy day, it had a suffocating weight of its own. Some days, this is how it felt when I was in the hospital, trapped in an endless jungle summer, wet with sweat, the rain of tears of the families of the dying pouring down. In the second year of training, you're the first to arrive in an emergency. Some patients you can't save, others you can. The first time I rushed a comatose patient from the ER to the OR, drained the blood from his skull, and then watched him wake up, start talking to his family, and complain about the incision on his head, I got lost in a euphoric daze, promenading around the hospital at 2 a.m. until I had no sense of where I was. It took me 45 minutes to find my way back out. The schedule took a toll. As residents, we were working as much as 100 hours a week, though regulations officially capped our hours at 88. There was always more work to be done. My eyes watered, my head throbbed. I downed energy drinks at 2 a.m. At work, I could keep it together, but as soon as I walked out of the hospital, the exhaustion would hit me. I staggered through the parking lot, often napping in my car before driving the 15 minutes home to bed. Not all residents could stand the pressure. One was simply unable to accept blame or responsibility. He was a talented surgeon, but he could not admit when he'd made a mistake. I sat with him one day in the lounge as he begged me to help him save his career. "All you have to do," I said, "is look me in the eye and say I'm sorry. What happened was my fault, and I won't let it happen again." "But it was the nurse who..." "No, you have to be able to say it and mean it. Try again." "But no, say it." This went on for an hour before I knew he was doomed. The stress drove another resident out of the field entirely. She elected to leave for a less taxing job in consulting. Others would pay even higher prices. As my skills increased, so did my responsibility. Learning to judge whose life could be saved, whose couldn't be, and whose shouldn't be requires an unattainable prognostic ability. I made mistakes, rushing a patient to the OR to save only enough brain that his heart beats, but he could never speak. He eats through a tube, and he is condemned to an existence he would never want. I came to see this as a more egregious failure than a patient dying. The twilight existence of unconscious metabolism becomes an unbearable burden, usually left to an institution where the family, unable to attain closure, visits with increased rarity until the inevitable fatal bedsore or pneumonia sets in. Some insist on this life and embrace its possibility, eyes open. But many do not, or cannot, and the neurosurgeon must learn to adjudicate. I had started in this career, in part, to pursue death, to grasp it, uncloak it, and see it eye to eye, unblinking. Neurosurgery attracted me as much for its intertwining of brain and consciousness as for its intertwining of life and death. I had thought that a life spent in the space between the two would grant me not merely a stage for compassionate action, but an elevation of my own being, getting as far away from petty materialism, from self-important trivia, getting right there, to the heart of the matter, to truly life and death decisions and struggles. Surely a kind of transcendence would be found there. But in residency, something else was gradually unfolding. In the midst of this endless barrage of head injuries, I began to suspect that being so close to the fiery light of such moments only blinded me to their nature, like trying to learn astronomy by staring directly at the sun. I was not yet with patients in their pivotal moments. I was merely at those pivotal moments. I observed a lot of suffering. Worse, I became inured to it. Drowning even in blood, one adapts, learns to float, to swim, even to enjoy life, bonding with the nurses, doctors, and others who are clinging to the same raft, caught in the same tide. My fellow resident Jeff and I worked traumas together when he called me down to the trauma bay because of a concurrent head injury. We were always in sync. He'd assess the abdomen, then ask for my prognosis on a patient's cognitive functions. Well, he could still be a senator, I once replied, but only from a small state. Jeff laughed, and from that moment on, state population became our barometer for head injury severity. Is he a Wyoming or a California? Jeff would ask, trying to determine how intensive his care plan should be. Or I'd say, Jeff, I know his blood pressure is liable, but I gotta get him to the OR or he's going to go from Washington to Idaho. Can you get him stabilized? In the cafeteria one day, as I was grabbing my typical lunch, a Diet Coke and an ice cream sandwich, my pager announced an incoming major trauma. I ran to the trauma bay, tucking my ice cream sandwich between a computer just as the paramedics arrived, pushing the gurney, reciting the details. 22-year-old male, motorcycle accident, 40 miles per hour, possible brain coming out of his nose. I went straight to work, called for an intubation tray, assessing his other functions. Once he was safely intubated, I surveyed his various injuries. The bruised face, the road rash, the dilated pupils. We pumped him full of mannitol to reduce brain swelling and rushed him to the scanner. A shattered skull, heavy diffuse bleeding. In my mind, I was already planning the scalp incision, how I'd drill the bone, evacuate the blood. His blood pressure suddenly dropped. We rushed him back to the trauma bay, and just as the rest of the trauma team arrived, his heart stopped. A whirlwind of activity surrounded him. Catheters were slipped into his femoral arteries, tubes shoved deep into his chest, drugs pushed into his IVs, and all the while fists pounding on his heart to keep the blood flowing. After 30 minutes, we let him finish dying. With that kind of head injury, we all murmured in agreement, death was to be preferred. I slipped out of the trauma bay just as the family was brought in to view the body. Then I remembered my Diet Coke, my ice cream sandwich, and the sweltering heat of the trauma bay. With one of the ER residents covering for me, I slipped back in, ghost-like, to save the ice cream sandwich in front of the corpse of the son I could not. 30 minutes in the freezer resuscitated the sandwich. Pretty tasty, I thought, picking the chocolate chips out of my teeth as the family said its last goodbyes. I wondered if in my brief time as a physician I had made more moral slides than strides. A few days later, I heard that Lori, a friend from medical school, had been hit by a car and that a neurosurgeon had performed an operation to try to save her. She coded, was revived, and then died the following day. I didn't want to know more. The days when someone was simply killed in a car accident were long gone. Now those words opened a Pandora's box, out of which emerged all the images, the roll of the gurney, the blood on the trauma bay floor, the tube shoved down her throat, the pounding on her chest. I could see hands, my hands, shaving Lori's scalp, the scalpel cutting open her head, could hear the frenzy of the drill and smell the burning bone, its dust whirling, the crack as I pried off a section of her skull, her hair half-shaven, her head deformed. She failed to resemble herself at all. She became a stranger to her friends and family. Maybe there were chest tubes and a leg was in traction. I didn't ask for details. I already had too many. In that moment, all my occasions of failed empathy came rushing back to me. The times I had pushed discharge over patient worries, ignored patient's pain when other demands pressed. The people whose suffering I saw, noted, and neatly packaged into various diagnoses, the significance of which I failed to recognize. They all returned, vengeful, angry, inexorable. I feared I was on the way to becoming Tolstoy's stereotype of a doctor, preoccupied with empty formalization, focused on the rote treatment of disease, and utterly missing the larger human significance. Quote, doctors came to see her singly and in consultation, talked much in French, German, and Latin, blamed one another, and prescribed a great variety of medicines for all the diseases known to them. But the simple idea never occurred to any of them that they could not know the disease Natasha was suffering from. Unquote. A mother came to me, newly diagnosed with brain cancer. She was confused, scared, overcome by uncertainty. I was exhausted, disconnected. I rushed through her questions, assured her that surgery would be a success, and assured myself that there wasn't enough time to answer her questions fairly. But why didn't I make the time? A truculent vet refused the advice and coaxing of doctors, nurses, and physical therapists for weeks. As a result, his back wound broke down, just as we had warned him it would. Called out of the OR, I stitched the dehiscent wound as he yelped in pain, telling myself he'd had it coming. Nobody has it coming. I took meager solace in knowing that William Carlos Williams and Richard Seltzer had confessed to doing worse, and I swore to do better. Amid the tragedies and failures, I feared I was losing sight of the singular importance of human relationships, not between patients and their families, but between doctor and patient. Technical excellence was not enough. As a resident, my highest ideal was not saving lives, everyone dies eventually, but guiding a patient or family to an understanding of death or illness. When a patient comes in with a fatal head bleed, that first conversation with a neurosurgeon may forever color how the family remembers the death, from a peaceful letting go, maybe it was his time, to an open sore of regret. Those doctors didn't listen. They didn't even try to save him. When there's no place for the scalpel, words are the surgeon's only tool. For amid the unique suffering invoked by severe brain damage, the suffering often felt more by families than by patients. It is not merely the physician who do not see the full significance. The families who gather around their beloved whose sheared head contains battered brains, do not usually recognize the full significance either. They see the past, the accumulation of memories, the freshly felt love, all represented by the body before them. I see the possible futures, the breathing machines connected through a surgical opening in the neck, a pasty liquid dripping in through a hole in the belly, the possible long, painful, and only partial recovery, or sometimes, more likely, no return at all of the person they remembered. In those moments, I acted not, as I most often did, as death's enemy, but as its ambassador. I had to help those families understand that the person they knew, the full, vital, independent human, now lived only in the past, and that I needed their input to understand what sort of future he or she would want. An easy death, or to be strung between bags of fluids going in, others coming out, to persist despite being unable to struggle. Had I been more religious in my youth, I might have become a pastor, for it was the pastoral role I'd sought. With my renewed focus, informed consent, the ritual by which a patient signs a piece of paper authorizing surgery, became not a juridical exercise in naming all the risks as quickly as possible, like the voiceover in an ad for a new pharmaceutical, but an opportunity to forge a covenant with a suffering compatriot. Here we are together, and here are the ways through. I promise to guide you, as best as I can, to the other side. By this point in my residency, I was more efficient and experienced. I could finally breathe a little, no longer trying to hang on for my own dear life. I was now accepting full responsibility for my patient's well-being. My thoughts turned to my father. As medical students, Lucy and I had attended his hospital rounds in Kingman, watching as he brought comfort and levity to his patients. To one woman who was recovering from a cardiac procedure, "Are you hungry? What can I get you to eat?" "Anything," she says, "I'm starving." "Well, how about lobster and steak?" He picked up the phone and called the nursing station. "My patient needs lobster and steak, right away." Turning back to her, he said with a smile, "It's on the way, but it may look more like a turkey sandwich." The easy human connections he formed, the trust he installed in his patients, were an inspiration to me. A 35-year-old sat in her ICU bed, a sheen of terror on her face. She had been shopping for her sister's birthday when she'd had a seizure. A scan showed that a benign brain tumor was pressing on her right frontal lobe. In terms of operative risk, it was the best kind of tumor to have, and the best place to have it. Surgery would almost certainly eliminate her seizures. The alternative was a lifetime on toxic anti-seizure medications, but I could see that the idea of brain surgery terrified her more than most. She was lonesome and in a strange place, having been swept out of the familiar hubbub of a shopping mall and into the alien beeps and alarms and antiseptic smells of an ICU. She would likely refuse surgery if I launched into a detailed spiel detailing all the risks and possible complications. I could do so, document her refusal in the chart, consider my duty discharged, and move on to the next task. Instead, with her permission, I gathered her family with her, and together we calmly talked through the options. As we talked, I could see the enormousness of the choice she faced dwindle into a difficult but understandable decision. I had met her in a space where she was a person instead of a problem to be solved. She chose surgery. The operation went smoothly. She went home 2 days later and never seized again. Any major illness transforms a patient's, really an entire family's life. But brain diseases have the additional strangeness of the esoteric. A son's death already defies the parents' ordered universe. How much more incomprehensible is it when the patient is brain dead, his body warm, his heart still beating? The root of disaster means a star coming apart, and no image expresses better the look in a patient's eyes when hearing a neurosurgeon's diagnosis. Sometimes the news so shocks the mind that the brain suffers an electrical short. This phenomenon is known as psychogenic syndrome, a severe version of the swoon some experience after hearing bad news. When my mother, alone at college, heard that her father, who had championed her right to an education in rural 1960s India, had finally died after a long hospitalization, she had a psychogenic seizure, which continued until she returned home to attend the funeral. One of my patients, upon being diagnosed with brain cancer, fell suddenly into a coma. I ordered a battery of labs, scans, and EEGs, searching for a cause without result. The definitive test was the simplest. I raised the patient's arm above his face and let go. A patient in a psychogenic coma retains just enough volition to avoid hitting himself. The treatment consists in speaking reassuringly until your words connect and the patient awakens. Cancer of the brain comes in two varieties: primary cancers, which are born in the brain, and metastases, which immigrate from somewhere else in the body, most commonly from the lungs. Surgery does not cure the disease, but it does prolong life. For most people, cancer in the brain suggests death within a year, maybe two. Mrs. Lee was in her late 50s, with pale green eyes, and had transferred to my service 2 days earlier from a hospital near her home 100 miles away. Her husband, his plaid shirt tucked into crisp jeans, stood by her bedside, fidgeting with his wedding ring. I introduced myself and sat down, and she told me her story. For the past few days, she had felt a tingling in her right hand, and then she began to lose control of it until she could no longer button her blouse. She'd gone to her local ER, fearing she was having a stroke. An MRI was obtained there, and she was sent here. "Did anyone tell you what the MRI showed?" I asked. "No." The buck had been passed, as it often was with difficult news. Oftentimes, we'd have a spat with the oncologist over whose job it was to break the news. How many times had I done the same? Well, I figured it can stop here. "Okay," I said, "we have a lot to talk about. If you don't mind, can you tell me what you understand is happening? It's always helpful for me to hear, to make sure I don't leave anything unanswered." "Well, I thought I was having a stroke, but I guess I'm not." "That's right. You aren't having a stroke." I paused. I could see the vastness of the chasm between the life she had had last week and the one she was about to enter. She and her husband didn't seem ready to hear brain cancer. "Is anyone?" So I began a couple of steps back. "The MRI shows a mass in your brain which is causing your symptoms." Silence. "Do you want to see the MRI?" "Yes." I brought up the image on the bedside computer, pointing out her nose, eyes, and ears to orient her. Then I scrolled up to the tumor, a lumpy white ring surrounding a black necrotic core. "What's that?" she asked. "Could be anything, maybe an infection. We won't know till after surgery." My inclination to dodge the question still persisted, to let their obvious worries float in their heads, unpinned. "We can't be sure until after surgery," I began, "but it looks very much like a brain tumor." "Is it cancer?" "Again, we won't know for certain until it is removed and examined by our pathologist. But if I had to guess, I would say yes." Based on the scan, there was no doubt in my mind that this was a glioblastoma, an aggressive brain cancer, the worst kind. Yet I proceeded softly, taking my cues from Mrs. Lee and her husband. Having introduced the possibility of brain cancer, I doubted they would recall much else. A tureen of tragedy was best allotted by the spoonful. Only a few patients demanded the whole at once. Most needed time to digest. They didn't ask about prognosis, unlike in trauma, where you have only about 10 minutes to explain and make a major decision. Here I could let things settle. I discussed in detail what to expect over the next couple of days, what the surgery entailed, how we'd shave only a small strip of her hair to keep it cosmetically appealing, how her arm would likely get a little weaker afterward, but then stronger again, that if all went well, she'd be out of the hospital in 3 days, that this was just the first step in a marathon, that getting rest was important, and that I didn't expect them to retain anything I had just said, and we'd go over everything again. After surgery, we talked again, this time discussing chemo, radiation, and prognosis. By this point, I had learned a couple of basic rules. First, detailed statistics are for research halls, not hospital rooms. The standard statistic, the Kaplan-Meier curve, measures the number of patients surviving over time. It is the metric by which we gauge progress, by which we understand the ferocity of a disease. For glioblastoma, the curve drops sharply until only about 5% of patients are alive at 2 years. Second, it is important to be accurate, but you must always leave some room for hope. Rather than saying, median survival is 11 months, or you have a 95% chance of being dead in 2 years, I'd say most patients live many months to a couple of years. This was, to me, a more honest description. The problem is that you can't tell an individual patient where she sits on the curve. Will she die in 6 months or 60? I came to believe that it is irresponsible to be more precise than you can be accurate. Those apocryphal doctors who give specific numbers, the doctor told me I had 6 months to live, who were they? I wondered, and who taught them statistics? Patients, when hearing the news, mostly remain mute. One of the early meanings of patient, after all, is one who endures hardship without complaint. Whether out of dignity or shock, silence usually reigns, and so holding a patient's hand becomes the mode of communication. A few immediately hardened, usually the spouse rather than the patient, "We're going to fight and beat this thing, Doc." The armament varies from prayer to wealth to herbs to stem cells. To me, that hardness always seems brittle, unrealistic optimism, the only alternative to crushing despair. In any case, in the immediacy of surgery, a warlike attitude fit. In the OR, the dark gray rotting tumor seemed an invader in the fleshy peach convolutions of the brain, and I felt real anger. "Got you, you fucker," I muttered. Removing the tumor was satisfying, even though I knew that microscopic cancer cells had already spread throughout the healthy-looking brain. The nearly inevitable reoccurrence of a problem for another day. A spoonful at a time. Openness to human rationality does not mean revealing grand truths from the apse. It means meeting patients where they are, in the narthex or nave, and bringing them as far as you can. Yet openness to human rationality also carried a price. One evening, in my third year, I ran into Jeff, my friend in general surgery, a similarly intense and demanding profession. We each noted the other's despondency. You go first, he said. And I described the death of a child, shot in the head for wearing the wrong color shoes. But he had been so close to making it. Amid a recent spat of fatal inoperable brain tumors, my hopes had been pinned on this kid pulling through, and he hadn't. Jeff paused, and I awaited his story. Instead, he laughed, punched me in the arm, and said, "Well, I guess I learned one thing. If I'm ever feeling down about my work, I can always talk to a neurosurgeon to cheer myself up." Driving home late that night, after gently explaining to a mother that her newborn had been born without a brain and would die shortly, I switched on the radio. NPR was reporting on the continuing drought in California. Suddenly, tears were streaming down my face. Being with patients in these moments certainly had its emotional cost, but it also had its rewards. I don't think I ever spent a minute of any day wondering why I did this work or whether it was worth it. The call to protect life, and not merely life but another's identity, it is perhaps not too much to say another's soul, was obvious in its sacredness. Before operating on a patient's brain, I realized I must first understand his mind, his identity, his values, what makes his life worth living, and what devastation makes it reasonable to let that life end. The cost of my dedication to succeed was high, and the ineluctable failings brought me nearly unbearable guilt. Those burdens are what make medicine holy and wholly impossible. In taking up another's cross, one must sometimes get crushed by the weight. Midway through residency, time is set aside for additional training. Perhaps unique in medicine, the ethos of neurosurgery, of excellence in all things, maintains that excellence in neurosurgery alone is not enough. In order to carry the field, neurosurgeons must venture forth and excel in other fields as well. Sometimes this is very public, as in the case of the neurosurgeon journalist Sanjay Gupta, but most often the doctor's focus is on a related field. The most rigorous and prestigious path is that of neurosurgeon neuroscientist. In my fourth year, I began work in a Stanford lab dedicated to basic motor neuroscience and the development of neural prosthetic technology that would allow, say, paralyzed people to mentally control a computer cursor or robot arm. The head of the lab, a professor of electrical engineering and neurobiology, a fellow second-generation Indian, was affectionately called V by everyone. V was 7 years older than I, but we got on like brothers. His lab had become a world leader in reading out brain signals, but with his blessing, I embarked on a project to do the reverse to write signals into the brain. After all, if your robot arm can't feel how hard it's grasping a wine glass, you will break a lot of wine glasses. The implications of writing signals into the brain, or neuromodulation, however, were far more wide-reaching than that. Being able to control neural firing would conceivably allow treatment of a host of currently untreatable or intractable neurological and psychiatric diseases, from major depression to Huntington's to schizophrenia to Tourette's to OCD. The possibilities were limitless. Putting surgery aside now, I set to work learning to apply new techniques in gene therapy in a series of first-of-its-kind experiments. After I'd been there for a year, V and I sat down for one of our weekly meetings. I had grown to love these chats. V was not like other scientists I knew. He was soft-spoken and cared deeply about people and the clinical mission, and he often confessed to me that he wished he'd been a surgeon himself. Science, I had come to learn, is as political, competitive, and fierce a career as you can find, full of the temptations to find easy paths. One could count on V to always choose the honest and often self-effacing way forward. While most scientists connive to publish in the most prestigious journals and get their names out there, V maintained that our only obligation was to be authentic to the scientific story and to tell it uncompromisingly. I'd never met someone so successful who was also so committed to goodness. V was an actual paragon. Instead of smiling as I sat down across from him, he looked pained. He sighed and said, "I need you to wear your doctor hat right now." "Okay. They tell me I have pancreatic cancer." "V, oh, okay, tell me the story." He laid out his gradual weight loss, indigestion, and recent precautionary CT scan, a truly non-standard procedure at this point, which showed a pancreatic mass. We discussed the way forward, the dreaded Whipple operation in his near future. "You're going to feel like a truck hit you," I told him. Who the best surgeons were, the impact the illness would have on his wife and children, and how to run the lab during his prolonged absence. Pancreatic cancer has a dismal prognosis, but of course there was no way to know what that meant for V. He paused. "Paul," he said, "do you think my life has meaning? Did I make the right choices?" It was stunning. Even someone I considered a moral exemplar had these questions in the face of mortality. V's surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation treatments were trying, but a success. He was back at work a year later, just as I was returning to my clinical duties in the hospital. His hair had thinned and whitened, and the spark in his eyes had dulled. During our final weekly chat, he turned to me and said, "You know, today is the first day it all seems worth it. I mean, obviously, I would have gone through anything for my kids, but today is the first day that all the suffering seems worth it." How little do doctors understand the hells through which we put patients? In my sixth year, I returned to the hospital full-time. My research in V's lab now regulated to days off and idle moments such as they were. Most people, even your closest colleagues, don't quite understand the black hole that is neurosurgical residency. One of my favorite nurses, after sticking around until 10 p.m. one night to help us finish a long and difficult case, said to me, "Thank God I have tomorrow off. Do you too?" "No. But at least you can come in later or something, right? When do you usually get in?" "6 a.m. "No, really?" "Yep." "Every day?" "Every day. Weekends too." "Don't ask." In residency, there's a saying, "The days are long, but the years are short." In neurosurgical residency, the day usually begins at 6 a.m. and lasts until the operating was done, which depended in part on how quick you were in the OR. A resident's surgical skill is judged by his technique and his speed. You can't be sloppy, and you can't be slow. From your first wound closure onward, spend too much time being precise, and the scrub tech will announce, "Looks like we got a plastic surgeon on our hands." Or, "I get your strategy. By the time you finish sewing the top half of the wound, the bottom will have healed on its own. Half the work. Very smart." A chief resident will advise a junior, "Learn to be fast now. You can learn to be good later." In the OR, everyone's eyes are always on the clock. For the patient's sake, how long has he been under anesthesia? During long procedures, nerves can get damaged, muscles can break down, kidneys can fail. For everyone else's sake, what time are we getting out of here tonight? I could see that there were two strategies to cutting the time short, perhaps best exemplified by the tortoise and the hare. The hare moves as fast as possible, hands a blur, instruments clattering, falling to the floor. The skin slips open like a curtain. The skull flap is on the tray before the bone dust settles. As a result, the opening might need to be expanded a centimeter here or there because it's not optionally placed. The tortoise, on the other hand, proceeds deliberately with no wasted movements, measuring twice, cutting once. No step of the operation needs revisiting. Everything moves in a precise, orderly fashion. If the hare makes too many minor missteps and has to keep adjusting, the tortoise wins. If the tortoise spends too much time planning each step, the hare wins. The funny thing about time in the OR, whether you race frenetically or proceed steadily, is that you have no sense of its passing. If boredom is, as Heidegger argued, the awareness of time passing, then surgery felt like the opposite. The intense focus makes the arms of the clock seem arbitrarily placed. 2 hours could feel like a minute. Once the final stitch was placed and the wound was dressed, normal time suddenly restarts. You could almost hear an audible whoosh. Then you started wondering, how long until the patient wakes up? How long until the next case is rolled in? And what time will I get home tonight? It wasn't until the last case finished that I felt the length of the day, the drag in my step. Those last few administrative tasks before leaving the hospital were like anvils. Could it wait until tomorrow? No. A sigh, and Earth continued to rotate back toward the sun. As a chief resident, nearly all responsibility fell on my shoulders, and the opportunities to succeed or fail were greater than ever. The pain of failure had led me to understand that technical excellence was a moral requirement. Good intentions were not enough, not when so much depended on my skills, when the difference between tragedy and triumph was defined by 1 or 2 millimeters. One day, Matthew, a little boy with the brain tumor who had charmed the ward a few years back, was readmitted. His hypothalamus had, in fact, been slightly damaged during the operation to remove his tumor. The adorable 8-year-old was now a 12-year-old monster. He never stopped eating. He threw violent fits. His mother's arms were scarred with purple scratches. Eventually, Matthew was institutionalized. He had become a demon, summoned by 1 millimeter of damage. For every surgery, a family and a surgeon decide together that the benefits outweigh the risks, but this was still heartbreaking. No one wanted to think about what Matthew would be like as a 300-pound, 20-year-old. Another day, I placed an electrode 9 centimeters deep in a patient's brain to treat a Parkinson's tremor. The target was the subthalamic nucleus, a tiny almond-shaped structure deep in the brain. Different parts of it subserved different functions: movement, cognition, emotion. In the operating room, we turned on the current to assess the tremor. With all our eyes on the patient's left hand, we agreed the tremor looked better. Then the patient's voice, confused, rose above our affirmative murmurs. "I feel overwhelmingly sad." "Current off," I said. "Oh, now the feeling is going away," the patient said. "Let's recheck the current and impedance." "Okay?" "Okay, current on." "No, everything. It just feels so sad. Just dark and sad." "Electrode out." We pulled the electrode out and reinserted it, this time 2 millimeters to the right. The tremor went away. The patient felt, thankfully, fine. Once I was doing a late-night case with one of the neurosurgery attendings, a suboccipital craniectomy for a brainstem malformation. It's one of the most elegant surgeries, in perhaps the most difficult part of the body. Just getting there is tricky, no matter how experienced you are. But that night, I felt fluid. The instruments were like extensions of my fingers. The skin, muscle, and bone seemed to unzip themselves, and there I was, staring at a yellow, glistening bulge, a mass deep in the brain stem. Suddenly, the attending stopped me. "Paul, what happens if you cut 2 millimeters deeper right here?" he pointed. Neuroanatomy slides whirled through my head. "Double vision." "No," he said. "Locked-in syndrome." Another 2 millimeters, and the patient would be completely paralyzed, save for the ability to blink. He didn't look up from the microscope. And I know this because the third time I did this operation, that's exactly what happened. Neurosurgery requires a commitment to one's own excellence and a commitment to another's identity. The decision to operate at all involves an appraisal of one's own abilities, as well as a deep sense of who the patient is and what she holds dear. Certain brain areas are considered near inviolable, like the primary motor cortex, damage to which results in paralysis of affected body parts. But most sacrosanct regions of the cortex are those that control language. Usually located on the left side, they are called Wernicke's and Branca's areas. One is for understanding language and the other for producing it. Damage to Branca's areas results in an ability to speak or write, though the patient can easily understand language. Damage to Wernicke's areas results in an inability to understand language, though the patient can still speak. The language she produces is a stream of unconnected words, phrases, and images. a grammar without semantics. If both areas are damaged, the patient becomes an isolate, something central to her humanity stolen forever. After someone suffers a head trauma or a stroke, the destruction of these areas often restrains the surgeon's impulse to save a life. What kind of life exists without language? When I was a med student, the first patient I met with this sort of problem was a 62-year-old man with a brain tumor. We strolled into his room on morning rounds, and the resident asked him, Mr. Michaels, how are you feeling today? 4-6-1-8-19, he replied, somewhat affably. The tumor had interrupted his speech circuitry, so he could speak only in streams of numbers, but he still had prosody. He could still emote, smile, scowl, sigh. He recited another series of numbers, this time with urgency. There was something he wanted to tell us, but the digits could communicate nothing other than his fear and fury. The team prepared to leave the room. For some reason, I lingered. 4128, he pleaded with me, holding my hand. 4128. I'm sorry. 4128, he said mournfully, staring into my eyes. And then I left to catch up to the team. He died a few months later, buried with whatever message he had for the world. When tumors or malformations abut these language areas, the surgeon takes numerous precautions, ordering a host of different scans, a detailed neurophysiological examination. Critically, however, the surgery is performed with the patient awake and talking. Once the brain is exposed, before the tumor excision, the surgeon uses a handheld ball-tip electrode to deliver electrical current to stun a small area of the cortex while the patient performs various verbal tasks, naming objects, reciting the alphabet, and so on. When the electrode sends current into a critical piece of cortex, it disrupts the patient's speech. A, B, C, D, E, glu, gr, F, G, H. The brain and the tumor are thus mapped to determine what can be resected safely, and the patient is kept awake throughout, occupied with a combination of verbal tasks and small talk. One evening, as I was prepping for one of these cases, I reviewed the patient's MRI and noted that the tumor completely covered the language areas. Not a good sign. Reviewing the notes, I saw that the hospital's tumor board, an expert panel of surgeons, oncologists, radiologists, and pathologists, had deemed the case too dangerous for surgery. How could the surgeon have opted to proceed? I became a little indignant. At a certain point, it was our job to say no. The patient was wheeled into the room, his eyes fixed on me, and pointed to his head. I want this thing out of my fucking brain. Got it? The attending strolled in and saw the expression on my face. I know, he said. I tried talking him out of this for about 2 hours. But don't bother. Ready to go. Instead of the usual alphabet recital or counting exercise, we were treated throughout the surgery to a litany of profanity and exhortation. Is that fucking thing out of my head yet? Why are you slowing down? Go faster. I want it out. I can stay here all fucking day. I don't care. Just get it out. I slowly removed the enormous tumor, attentive to the slightest hint of speech difficulty. With the patient's monologue unceasing, the tumor now sat on a Petri dish, his clean brain gleaming. Why'd you stop? What, you some kind of asshole? I told you I want the fucking thing gone. It's done, I said. It's out. How is he still talking? Given the size and location of the tumor, it seemed impossible. Profanity supposedly ran on a slightly different circuit from the rest of language. Perhaps the tumor had caused his brain to rewire somehow. But the skull wasn't going to close itself. There would be time for speculation tomorrow. I had reached the pinnacle of residency. I had mastered the core operations. My research had garnered the highest awards. Job interest was trickling in from all over the country. Stanford launched a search for a position that fit my interest exactly, for a neurosurgeon neuroscientist focused on technique of neural modulation. One of my junior residents came up to me and said, "I just heard from the bosses. If they hire you, you're going to be my faculty mentor." "Shh," I said, "don't jinx it." It felt to me as if the individual strands of biology, morality, life, and death were finally beginning to weave themselves into, if not a perfect moral system, a coherent worldview and a sense of my place in it. Doctors in highly charged fields met patients at inflected moments, the most authentic moments, where life and identity were under threat. Their duty included learning what made that particular patient's life worth living and planning to save those things, if possible, or to allow the peace of death, if not. Such power required deep responsibility, sharing in guilt and recrimination. I was at a conference in San Diego when my phone rang, my co-resident, Victoria. "Paul?" Something was wrong. My stomach tightened. "What's up?" I said. Silence. "Vic, it's Jeff. He killed himself." "What?" Jeff was finishing his surgical fellowship in the Midwest, and we were both so punishingly busy, we'd lost touch. I tried to recall our last conversation and couldn't. He apparently had a difficult complication, and his patient died. Last night, he climbed onto the roof of a building and jumped off. I really don't know anything else. I searched for a question to bring understanding. None was forthcoming. I could only imagine the overwhelming guilt, like a tidal wave that had lifted him up and off that building. I wished desperately that I could have been walking with him out the door of the hospital that evening. I wished we could have commiserated as we used to. I wished I could have told Jeff what I had come to understand about life and our chosen way of life, if only to hear his wise, clever counsel. Death comes for all of us. For us, for our patients, it is our fate as living, breathing, metabolizing organisms. Most lives are lived with passivity toward death. It's something that happens to you and those around you. But Jeff and I had trained for years to actively engage with death, to grapple with it, like Jacob with the angel, and in so doing, to confront the meaning of a life. We had assumed an onerous yoke, that of moral responsibility. Our patients' lives and identities may be in our hands, yet death always wins. Even if you are perfect, the world isn't. The secret is to know that the deck is stacked, that you will lose, that your hands or judgment will slip, and yet still struggle to win for your patients. You can't ever reach perfection, but you can believe in an asymptote toward which you are ceaselessly striving.